welcome to the List Film Podcast. What's up, guys? Everybody's excited. Everybody's got bourbon. There's talk of crappy bourbon, good bourbon. All right, but we're not talking about bourbon today. We're talking about, what are we talking about, guys? Film noir. Yeah.
Wait, all right. This is not the bourbon podcast.
This isn't
bourbon. Damn podcast. It.
Sorry. Well, that's next week.
You're going to have to change your whole list.
Yeah. So for the new listeners, we are a weekly film podcast where we list and discuss our top five favorite films, actresses, actors, what have you, pets, favorite, you know, fishes in film. I don't know. But I am one of your hosts, Ricardo.
I'm Adam Scott.
I'm Kevin.
And our frequent contributor, collaborator, there's many words for to describe this dude. Not related to no, I'm not going to do that joke again. Who is it? It's
Brandon Bennett.
Yeah, you were really excited about that. I feel like I introduced you, and then like I stopped you, and you lost your momentum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
I got to get the ball rolling. I need more bourbon.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you have a fever, and the only cure is more bourbon. All right. What's going on? Everybody's excited?
I just listened to the Favorite Actress podcast
that you weren't on, yeah.
And can I say that Audrey Hepburn got ripped? I mean, not by Brandon. Brandon brought her up as an honorable mention, but everybody else seemed to kind of just shit on Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, I did.
And if you watch the last scene in Roman Holiday, there's the scene where she's just standing there and it's all her acting through her eyes. Amazing. And then Wait Until Dark. Just go check those movies out and then reevaluate Audrey.
Have you seen The Children's Hour?
Children's Hour.
I've seen that.
And Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah. But my thing is just like everyone jacks her off for Breakfast at Tiffany's and stuff. And
who cares about Breakfast at Tiffany's? There's so many other movies.
People are jacking off Audrey Hepburn way too much.
Yeah. Just.
And that's a really overrated
quota
movie.
I would
say Roman Holiday over it.
Charade.
Sabrina.
Oh, yeah.
Wait Until Dark. And Funny Face.
Oh, Funny Face.
Seriously.
All right. All right. Sure. Yeah, maybe you'll change your mind.
Well, that sounds like a convert to me. Good job, Kevin.
Yes. One down.
All right. So what are we talking about this week? We're talking about film noir. But first, let's talk a little bit about the films we've seen. Theaters or anything new you've seen. What's going on, guys? Not everybody. Hold on. Not everybody at once. One at a time, guys.
None of us actually said a movie. Yeah.
I went to go see Total Recall.
Okay.
At the Egyptian in 70mm.
The original.
With Verhoeven.
How was that?
Verhoeven and two of the writers. It was very good. I really liked it because I haven't seen it for years and put in perspective with everything else Verhoeven was doing in the late 80s, early 90s. It makes complete sense. Just the way he treats Schwarzenegger as an everyman in this like weird, it's just so absurd. Mm-hmm. The scene, I haven't been to comedies where people were laughing as hard in the opening scene with him and Sharon Stone, where it's supposed to be this kind of dramatic thing. But just the fact that you put Arnold Schwarzenegger there, it becomes ridiculous. and it plays on the whole thing. It's just really great.
He's every man.
Yeah. 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 I've been a sheriff for... Oh, my God. Cut that out.
I want to see that. All right.
It was in the last the trailer.
The hell with you.
The trailer for The Last Stand. He plays another, old.
Yeah.
Possibly American.
No, he's American. He's American.
Yeah. Everyone,
all the way.
Every one of Schwarzenegger's movies is like the great story of the American immigrant.
He's the most American ever.
Yeah,
out of everyone.
He's always got high paying position. He's always done very well for himself, but is obviously not from here at all.
Yeah.
Not from a young age either.
No.
I'd like to see Schwarzenegger and Tommy Wiseau play relatives.
Ooh. That'd be interesting. I think that'd be a big seller. But did Verhoeven do a Q&A?
Yeah, they did a Q&A afterwards. It was really great. But like all Q&As, it was incredibly uncomfortable because there were just dumb questions like left and right, but they did their best to answer. Yeah. It's just, it's people, you know, it's like anything, whether, you know, back in school when someone is trying to show how smart they are, you know, using, you know, talking about like his satire or whatever, but it was good. I left about halfway through the Q&A actually.
I wish they filtered out, like, there's like a sort of mic that would filter out douchebags at Q&As, because I feel like it's called a Q&A, not you're going to talk for 5 minutes and then at the last 10 seconds it's your fucking question. Just give me your fucking question.
Everyone was just trying to figure out a way to get him to shit on the new Total Recall anyway, so once he did that, it was kind of over with.
Oh, nice. Well, that works for me. What did you say about the new Total Recall?
That it's shit.
Oh. Excellent. Anything else you guys saw in theaters?
I didn't see anything in theaters. I saw two movies, but I didn't see them in theaters.
Well, we should talk about VHS. We saw VHS.
Yes.
On demand. It comes out next month in a theater near you, I guess. Is it a wide release?
Probably,
right?
I mean,
I would think so.
It's Magnet, so wide-ish.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about it. I don't like it.
Yeah, I was disappointed.
I mean, it had some cool things, but yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah, we had a double feature. We had VHS and then Video Dead.
Now that, Video Dead, I think, was the highlight of my evening.
go out, get yourself some popcorn, settle in, and watch some Video Dead.
Why did you not like VHS?
It's basically, how many different, was like five or six?
Yeah, five or six.
It's like five or six vignettes explaining why found footage movies suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, here are the top five reasons why you should never make a found footage movie. Go.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like, and also I feel like the subtitle is like VHS. Knives and boobies.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just like...
But you like found footage, right?
I like some found footage.
I like knives and boobies.
Yeah, I like some found footage. I like knives.
And I love like finding knives and boobies. That's the best.
But it's just like... Oh, it's like the worst of it. Like, there are some interesting moments and there was some cool stuff. But for the most part, it's just like being... It's like being stuck on YouTube. Like, you have to watch all the douchey jock channels, like all of them doing stupid things. Like, just here, watch an hour and a half. Actually, I feel like it's longer than that.
Yeah.
It's almost
like
2 hours.
Yeah, like, here's 2 hours worth of douchebags that you want to see die. Go.
Yeah.
Except it's all shaky cam, and they're all woohooing, and it's always going out of focus, and they're doing all the digital effects to make it look like it's old tape.
Yeah.
It's annoying.
I paid $10 to see it, and I wish I just would have waited for like Netflix, so it's free. It's not that, I mean, it's not the worst thing I've seen, but not worth paying.
I guess this is all kind of bullshit for me because I haven't seen it yet, but yeah. I feel like generally found footage is all kind of the same. Is it just a matter of it's played out and this was the last nail in the coffin?
Not necessarily, because elements to it that I enjoyed, but I'd say a good 80% of the movie I didn't enjoy at all. It was just like, let's move on. Like, it was too much following people to get somewhere. It's like, we're in the car.
Yeah.
Like 40% of the movie, it's like they're in the car on their way somewhere. Like, that's all it is. Like, oh, and it's shaky cam, POV, someone turning and looking, people saying stupid things in the car.
Yeah.
That's 40% of the movie.
And people saying, let's party, let's rape.
Yeah, let's party.
Well, it's almost rape. but yeah, I feel like we spent too much fucking time in this movie. Let's fucking move on, dude. Let's move on. What else did we see? Anything else?
I saw Side by Side.
How was that? Adam talked about it last week, I think. But what's...
I liked it a lot. It was cool to see people...
What is Side by Side?
It's a film that was made by Keanu Reeves about documentary about kind of where the industry is going digitally and kind of looking at film compared to digital.
Just for a listener, by the way, I knew what it was.
That was cool though, because I missed it, and then you're like, "Bam!
No,
what's up?"
Keanu Reeves is just a producer and the narrator. Yeah, it's this guy Christopher Canali. However you say his name.
But I mean, Keanu was like asking the questions throughout.
Yeah. Well, I feel like he was a major impetus behind creating the movie.
Yeah.
Does it get like really deep? into why nerds are either for digital or against digital, for film, against film. No one's against film, but...
Some people are, actually. In the movie, there are some people who are very much against film.
Don't tell us. Yeah, and then there's some people who are against digital, and it's interesting to see. And it's interesting to see some people you would think are just like hardcore film people who are like, there's definite elements. Like when you hear Scorsese talking about digital, you're like, you would think that Martin Scorsese would be all about film. I mean, he preserves film.
Yeah.
And he realizes there are some elements to digital that can work.
Yeah, I think it's a very even-handed documentary where, like, Keanu plays the devil's advocate with both people, with like people who are pro digital and pro film. So like whoever he's talking to, he'll counter what they're saying. So it's not like he's favoring one side more than the other.
Scorsese. I had read somewhere that the Scorsese bit was just kind of like sounded sad because it just sounded like he was giving up. Like, I'm old. This is how it is. I don't think there's anything I can do about it at this point.
It didn't sound sad to me.
Yeah, no, it didn't sound sad to me either.
I mean, the saddest... Kevin and I were previously discussing the parts of the movie that seemed saddest, and I was listening to Robert Rodriguez talk about digital.
Because there were some people that were...
Sad listening to Robert Rodriguez talk.
That would talk about digital, and you'd go, wow, there's definitely a lot of benefits to doing digital. And then he would come on and be like, please remove the mentally challenged person from the screen and have someone else talk about it, please.
Well, it was sad.
He didn't say mentally challenged.
No, that was me talking about... That was me asking them to remove Robert Rodriguez because he was the mentally challenged person on the screen.
What was sad hearing someone talk about it was hearing Danny Boyle talk about not being able to use film. That was sad. Like him talking about... like, because he was the one that sounded like he had more reservations. Like, it's easier to do digital. But with him, there was like a hint of loss at...
There was, and the fact that he just can never use film again, he can only use digital.
I mean, he can use it very well, but he
why can he never use film again?
He feels just the ease with which you can use digital and the speed, and the industry's leaning towards that.
Yeah.
Part of it is kind of like a double-edged sword where he used it so effectively on 28 Days Later, and then it's just kind of what he's going to do now.
Mm-hmm.
I thought part of the whole, the impetus, like, you know, Nolan's a big pusher of film and trying to get people like Danny Boyle to use their power to keep film. So I'm wondering why, maybe this is the answer, but I'm wondering why like a guy like Danny Boyle can't stick to his guns, because he is very successful. He makes successful movies. And there's that story about Nolan like screening The Dark Knight Rises for a bunch of directors. And he's like, you know, this is really great and all, but the real reason I brought you here was to talk about how we need to stick to our guns and keep making movies on film as opposed to switching to digital. Because if anyone can do it, can have a say, it's you guys.
Right.
And it was like, you know, David Fincher and, you know, Spielberg, like everyone who could do that, who could say, yeah, I'll make the movie, but I'm going to make it on film.
Well, with Boyle, it seemed like he has kind of resigned himself to the sacrifice, like sacrificing film in order to make a movie that wouldn't necessarily get made otherwise. Like, it'd be easier. It's easier to make Slumdog Millionaire when you're using digital, because that wouldn't work with film.
I mean, just seeing the cameras that they used on Slumdog and how they were able to capture some of these shots, and it's just this small camera that they're holding in their hand that's like got a little box that you keep in your backpack, and they'll just capture these shots. And I mean, the thing that you learn while watching is, if you have somebody talented enough and what they're doing with digital, the benefits of digital can be very handy. I mean, I'm not saying film is still the most beautiful thing to see, but if you have somebody talented who can light it well, where they are with like the Red camera and the Sony camera that they have out, they can do some pretty amazing things.
It's like 3D. The only really great 3D movies are people who were already really great filmmakers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
And scene.
No, I was going to say somebody's name wasn't very good, but I'm like, no, I'm going to say it.
Okay. No, who was it?
No. What if, like, next week I'm, like, pitching a movie to that dude? And he's like, I looked you up, and you said this about me. I'll tell you after.
Ooh, behind the scenes at the List Film Podcast.
No. I'm going to bring this up.
So what else did you guys see? Anything else in theaters?
I saw Robot and Frank.
Ooh.
How was that?
Which is very good.
Really?
I loved it. I thought it was great. Really funny. Frank Langella is amazing. Susan Sarandon is great. James Marsden is great. Everyone. It was just a lot of fun. They endear you to a robot, which is always a plus.
Nice.
I mean, what other? I think Johnny Five is the other one that sticks out in my mind.
Wally. Terminator. RoboCop.
Which Terminator? Terminator 2 Terminator?
Terminator 2 Terminator.
Salvation.
Don't go there. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was touching. It was a pretty movie. I love the music. It's a fun time. Unlike The Possession, which I also saw, which was just kind of tedious. And
I like,
and then Modest Yahoo shows up.
What?
Yeah.
That's he's rapping?
Weird. He's the rabbi.
Man, I remember Modest Yahoo.
He's the rabbi that, like, they get to do the exorcism.
Really?
As watching this movie, I'm sitting there thinking, like, this guy just, like, sent his kid in, like, a 5-year-old kid to pitch this movie. It's like, and then she gets possessed from, because the demon's in the box. And then there are moths everywhere. And then Modest Yahoo shows up, and he saves her from the demon. And then there's a car.
Does he scat the right?
The right. It sounds exorcism. A bit like it does. I couldn't really tell. But I actually had to, like, stop. Because, like, he showed up. I'm like, wait a minute. Modest Yahoo? I was like, what? That just happened? Really? Like, I was, in my mind, I was joking and saying, what if he showed up? And then he showed up. Yeah. It was really weird.
Without the beard, right? Didn't he take off his beard?
I think it's shorter than it was in the past. But he's still got facial hair.
All right.
Going back to Robot and Frank. I love seeing James Marsden in good things.
Yes.
I wish he was in more stuff that was really good. Because he's really good.
Yeah. James Marsden is a Cyclops?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
he is really good.
He's always in, you know, okay movies, but he's usually the best part in it.
Even if he's in something that I don't love, I still usually enjoy his part of whatever
it
is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I'm going to confess, I saw Sugar and Spice, and he was amazing in that.
What is Sugar and Spice?
Sugar and Spice.
It's the ones with the cheerleaders.
Yeah. And he's amazing in that. He's, like, so funny. I'll see it again just because of him.
He's really good at playing stupid characters.
Yes.
He was great in Hairspray.
Yeah.
Yes, I like him in Hairspray.
Didn't see Hairspray?
No.
He's not in the musicals.
Yeah. But I did see him in, what is it? Was it Road Trip? What was that movie?
Hop?
Not Hop. No. You know what I'm talking about? Sex Drive.
Yeah.
He played the older brother. He was really good in that. Anything else, Brandon? Anything you've seen? Theaters?
I haven't seen anything else. I finally saw, I think I told Jenny earlier that it's a shame she wasn't here for this, but I did finally watch The Hunger Games.
What did you think?
It was great.
Yeah?
I really liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I thought she was really good. And it was, Woody Harrelson was really great. It was funny, though. I felt like the first 5 minutes it opens almost exactly like Winter's Bone. like with the family in the house. So it started, the first 5 minutes are like some weird alternate, you know, Appalachian Hunger Games.
That's interesting.
But I thought it was really great. It was more brutal than I was expecting for, you know, PG-13. The way that they showed violence was really smart to get away with PG-13 but still have that much blood going around.
Yeah.
It was really great. It was brutal in all the right parts and exciting. I really loved it.
I have no complaints. I never read the book or anything, so I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, I think I'll read. I'll probably read the second book, but I think
did
I'll,
you read
I
the
I'll
book?
Give it a try. Or, no, I didn't.
Okay.
And people have told me, like, and you didn't find it hard to follow? I was like, no.
Yeah, that's another complaint I heard, but I had no problems with it. No, anyway, it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. Well, whatever.
I just remembered. I also saw Lawless.
Oh, okay. So what do you think of that? I read your review.
I liked parts, and some parts kind of slowed down for me. If you want to hear me talk about it more, or read me talk about it more, just check out shootingthescript.com. But I don't know. It wasn't. I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as The Proposition.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree, but I still enjoyed it a lot. I don't like slow movies, so I enjoyed it.
It wasn't a matter of the slow or stillness. It was just kind of like, let's check out what's going on over here now. And, oh, there's the preacher. And, oh, let's see what's going on in this end of town. And, oh.
Who voiced the narrator?
I believe it was Gomer Pyle.
The guy who did the voiceover for Dukes of Hazzard. And let's see what these boys are up to now. But all right, let's get in. So what is the Netflix Stream of the Week?
Stream of the Week is on Netflix and Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, it is Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Yes.
It is incredible.
I've been, like, talking people's ears off about this movie.
Yeah. It might have changed my life a little bit.
It's funny. Wow. It's funny. I agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I wanted. I, that's you stole. The
I
words.
Have. I have always been.
You stole his dream.
Stole my dream of sushi.
I've always been fascinated with the part of Japanese culture that is about the idea of never being able to achieve perfection, but always seeking it. And that is what this movie is entirely about. The idea of devoting yourself to a single thing and it becoming like your all-consuming activity. Like, it is the thing you do in your life. And he is the best at it. And it's amazing. You know, this goes back to the other recommendation I had about El Bui.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to watch a guy who is the best in the world at a thing doing the thing, and how he does it and how he got there is well,
let's
inspiring.
Explain a little bit about what this movie's
oh,
about.
Oh yeah.
It's Euro or Gyro?
Giro.
Okay.
Giro.
Euro.
No, it's a sandwich.
Giro. We're doing Giro. A really good bit, but so what? This guy he's been a sushi chef. He's 80 years old? 82?
He's like 85.
85.
Yeah.
And he's still like perfecting his craft every effing day, and he doesn't like taking days off. And the story tells a couple different stories. Like, it tells the story of his son, his oldest son, who's going to take his place. And it's about whether you can live up to those expectations or whether you have already. It's about his other son as well, you know, how he kind of had to do his own thing. And it really gets in deep into not only like devoting yourself to one thing, but also like the cost of him devoting his life to this, you know, about, yeah, with his family, with his parents. It definitely has some really good life lessons.
And the idea of like the burden of the family being placed on the eldest son, you know, that's another, you know, Japanese cultural thing. And the younger son went off to open his own restaurant because, you know, it's the eldest son's responsibility to take over, you know, his father's. But you never want sushi more than after watching this. But I didn't have any because I knew I'd be disappointed.
Yeah.
It would just be completely inferior.
I thought this to myself. I really would like to have sushi from this guy, but if by the time I got around to traveling to that part of the world, he wasn't around because he's really old. I'm like, I would settle eating from, you know,
from his son. Oh, yeah. I would totally do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it'd be great to have him serve you and everything. Yeah. You would be a part of history, but it's still the same.
Yeah,
and just the intricacies of sushi itself was fascinating.
Oh yeah,
how they shop for the fish, their relationships with, you know, the fishmongers and the tuna, yeah, and like the how much knowledge those guys have about a fish. Like, beyond Jiro's mastering of sushi, these guys know tuna, absolutely everything about tuna that you could possibly know.
Yeah,
by instinct, on an instinctual level.
And you may think like this sounds boring, like I don't want to hear about, but no, it's really like the parallels to like just like how I want to kind of like devote myself to a certain thing, like whether it be writing or something. Like, it's like, wow, this guy, this is what it takes. Like, this guy's amazing.
It was a little bit of an existential crisis because I was like, well, shit, I got to pick a thing. Like, I got to pick one and stick with it because otherwise.
You're like, masturbation is not like my thing.
Yeah.
You're like, I mastered that and didn't take a lifetime, but.
Yeah. I was a quick learner. Quick study. I had a good teacher.
So, this movie's really amazing. And also, I like how they talk about, like, how they use sustainable, like fish, and, like, how he talks about that, about how...
Yeah, the responsibility you have to the planet to, you know, to not... to get the right fish, not at the expense of...
Yeah, I feel like... What?
Just the phrase sustainable fish is funny.
Yeah.
I saw him open for Quiet Riot one time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So check it out.
Now I definitely want to. That reminds me of a French movie that's coming out, too. Step Up to the Plate. About a French chef.
It's about the...
passing his restaurant on to his son.
Oh, okay.
It's not out yet, though.
There is another one on Netflix that's specifically about pastry chefs.
I think I've seen
about
that one.
About French pastry chefs. I've watched that one. That one is great. Yeah.
Yeah. Where they're like...
It's a competition. I can't remember the name of the award, but it's a prestigious French award that, you know, chefs from around the world go and compete with for, you know, to become a French master, you know, pastry or dessert chef.
Yeah.
It's not just pastries, but...
Yeah.
I have seen that one. That one's pretty interesting.
I feel when you mentioned Step Up to the Plate, I thought it was a prequel to Step Up. And I was like, whoa. All right.
That's what I thought the first time I saw the title, too. But then I read about
Step Up.
To the Plate.
To the Plate. Yeah.
If it was to do with Step Up, it'd be the number two instead of T-O. Step Up to the Plate.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
God, movie titles are the worst.
Too Fast, Too Furious. All right. Let's get into it. Where are we at? We're at 25 minutes and we haven't gotten to the list. Let's do it. We're talking about film noir. First of all, how did you guys include? I think I talked to you guys about how to include like new movies.
Neo-noir.
Yeah. Can I talk about that for a second?
Let's talk about
like noir specifically. I think it's interesting as a genre because as opposed to, I don't know, I feel like there's an inherent quality to it. I feel like there's some kind of rigidness to noir that makes people who like the great noirs were all kind of made in the same period.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so people who really love noir know the great noir movies. So I feel like the people who go to make a noir, I feel like there's a higher ratio of good noir films because the filmmakers understand the genre more than other genre pictures, like, I mean, horror specifically, because mm-hmm. there's so much shitty horror because there's
it's true
because there's been a lot of horror, but it's less so with noir because I think it's a little more difficult to get right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes someone who really knows the ins and outs of the genre to get it right.
Which it's weird.
Does that make any kind of sense?
It does.
Yes.
It makes a lot of sense. And it's one of, it's another thing that I've heard in my, because I love noir. And there's also a common feeling that it's not a genre, which is weird to say, but it's like it's a stylistic thing, it's like a weird haziness. Like, oh, what do you mean? It's a style, but it's not a genre. It's very bizarre. Because, and then the subgenres within the non-genre, where you've got like the wrong man or
mumble noir,
or the like. But within genre, there are different ways to go about it. And then, like, there's also the argument of the detective story versus the film noir, and then where they intersect, because not all detective stories are film noirs. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Where it's like, what falls under what category?
Yeah,
and I address that a little bit in my list. Where I'm like, all right, I'm gonna do my film noir list, but I'm not doing any detective stories.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
Because I would say a good portion of noir. It may not go the other way, but a good portion of noir movies are detective stories.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm saving those for if we ever do detective stories.
Excellent. Okay. Now, what was your criteria? How did you define noir, film noir? I want to hear.
Okay. Well, there's the classic film noir, which is that, like, doomy, gloomy.
High contrast.
Between,
which is more
like,
the
style
40s.
Thing. Yeah. Like the late 30, like 39 through like 50. Like, I want to say 60, actually, depending on the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, traditional film noir, I feel like, falls in that period. And then neo-noir comes in like, the 70s.
Okay.
With, like, even then, like, neo-noir is even hazier because it's like, all right, well, there's elements of noir in this, but some people don't consider it noir and some people do.
I would say it's, like, the Supreme Court definition of pornography.
I know when I see it.
Yeah, you know when you see it. It's a feeling more than anything else. Like there's you know, maybe a sense of dread.
Well, what about if
people push to their limits?
What if you feel it, but I don't feel it?
Well, then it's different tastes.
Okay. Well, can we just read?
But I would actually doubt that would happen with something that anyone would consider noir. I think you would probably concede that, yeah, it's got some, you know, noir styles to it, but mm-hmm. you know, maybe I just, it's not my kind. You know what I mean?
Would you say that film noir is strictly crime dramas or
no? It doesn't have to be.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Cause it's mood black. It's, you know, it's a feeling.
Okay. But what's a film noir that doesn't involve crime in some way?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. It was you brought it up. Answer that.
No, that's what I'm saying, because I
feel like
that.
There is a criminal element to it, but it's not necessarily about organized crime. Because
I mean, like, it's kind of like you can't have noir, I feel, without some sort of crime.
There's a criminal element.
Yeah.
There's some element of doom.
Yeah.
There's darkness that pops up a lot. Yeah.
Like literally or figuratively?
Both.
Okay. Yes.
There's the one, I'm trying to remember the director. The only thing that comes to mind is he's, I feel like he's a bigger name, but he's terrible at 3D.
Oh, okay.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
I think I do.
Who am I talking about?
He's a great director, you said?
Yeah, he's a great director, but shit at 3D.
Are you talking about James Cameron?
No, actually.
Is he good at 3D? Are you saying that he's good at 3D?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm still trying to get you to
Yeah, he's baiting
up.
You.
He's I'm just trying to get you to cough up the guy that you're going to pitch a movie to next week.
No.
It was fun to watch him bait you, though.
Yeah. Very interesting. I like that.
I told you I'd try.
So, Kevin?
Am I starting?
Well, I think he's asking you about your definition.
Yeah. My definition? I mean, pretty much everything they said, it's got to be, there's got to be a dark element to it. Not just necessarily stylistically, but just the story-wise, there's got to be something dark. I mean, I'm a big fan of the femme fatale, but I don't think that's a necessary element to film noir. But I think a lot of the ones that I like tend to have that element in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only overriding element is, I mean, crime just kind of dovetails into it because of the grimness.
Yes.
Like, it has to be dark. Yeah. I mean, that's why it's black cinema, like film noir. It's got to be dark and grim and bleak.
And mm-hmm. I would say it has to have some essence of people being pushed beyond their reasonable limits.
Yeah.
Or people being pushed somewhere where they wouldn't have normally gone.
Yeah.
Unless they were under these circumstances. Right.
Well, I mean, originally, the original film noir was very much in response to, like, coming back from World War II and just, like, this dark... World War II ended, the Depression, and it's just everyone's down in the dumps.
Yeah.
And we're not into the sunny 50s and 60s yet. It's, like, dark and shadowy and bleak. And
but, like, I would call, without getting into spoilers, I would call Breaking Bad a noir. Because it involves... taking a guy, mm-hmm. putting someone in a situation mm-hmm. where they go beyond where they thought they go. Well, not beyond, but further down than they thought they could ever go.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no.
Being pushed by external forces, whether accidental or
that makes sense. I feel like we're going to start stepping on people's movies.
Yeah.
Now. We should just get into it.
Okay. Let's get into it. Kevin, why don't you start us off?
Okay. So my number 5 is from 1944 and it's Laura. I love this movie. I forget when I first saw this. I think it was back in the day when I would have 10 Netflix movies at a time, and I think I rented it just because it was one of those movies that was on that people talked about. And I was at a time when I was just trying to absorb like as much film noir as possible, and I just get sucked into the story of pretty much the way the film opens up is this character Laura Hunt has been murdered at the beginning of the movie. She took two shotgun blasts to the face, and it's a detective trying to figure out who killed her and talking to friends and family, her fiance, and just trying to figure out who would have wanted to kill her. And just kind of how the detective, who's never met her, but just hearing stories of her and seeing how she lives, starts kind of becoming a little obsessed with her and almost kind of falling for her, as most people who have met her in her life kind of just fell for Laura. And so it's interesting to see that dynamic of how he's kind of falling in love with her, and this woman who's dead, just from hearing all these stories from people who knew her. And then it's interesting to see all the interesting characters that she was involved with. One person who technically considers himself like her best friend, who's kind of tried to manipulate her throughout her, like their friendship, trying to get her to break up with this guy because he doesn't think he's right for her. And it's really interesting to see how the characters play out, and it's got a really interesting twist and really interesting. And I really like the ending, and I just love the whole story. And it's really it's such an involved movie. It's only like an hour and 30 minutes and it just goes by like that.
I dig it. Good away. No, it's funny. I was waiting for someone to go, no. Or like, you know, like, I felt like eventually one of these picks were someone's going to say, no, I don't buy that. But I mean, I'm not clearly not with Laura.
Yeah, not
saying.
Laura.
Yeah. I'm saying like,
I feel like that's one of the I'm first waiting ones for it. That...
And I want to ask, what's the year of your, most present movie? like present time?
My oldest film is...
Newest
one, yeah, is 1951.
Really? And what about you guys?
My newest is 1993.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting.
1990.
Okay, cool. Okay, we're on the same page. I just wanted to make sure.
Oh, no,
I was...
1993. Oh.
Okay. Ooh. Oh. Teaser. All right, Adam.
Well, now I just want to skip over to Brandon to find out if it's the same movie.
All right, should we do 3, 2, 1?
Wait, is it your number 5?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to say it then.
Okay, say it.
Red Rock West, yeah.
Red Rock West.
Yes. So that's your number 4, too?
And that's my number 5.
It's my number 5 as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about it. It's just, okay, well, film noir western.
Yeah.
With Dennis Hopper and Nicolas Cage. That's really, I mean, that's all you really need to tell me, and I'm there.
And J.T. Walsh.
J.T. Walsh, rest great. Laura Flynn Boyle. She's good as a femme fatale.
And I love a good mistaken identity.
Yes. That's one of the key film noir things for me, is the wrong man, or the guy who just kind of falls into things.
Or the guy who takes the role,
yeah,
of someone else, not knowing that the guy he's taking the role of is in a really fucked up scenario.
Yeah. He's a drifter who comes into town. He's out of work. He's looking for a job.
Got a bum
leg. He stumbles into this bar. Oh, and there's a trailer playing on its own. He stumbles into this bar, and he's not even, I mean, someone else assumes that he's somebody, that he's...
J.T. Walsh assumes that he's the hitman he hired to kill his wife.
Right. And he just goes along with it. Nicolas Cage.
Because he's looking for work.
Yeah. And he just goes down the rabbit hole, and things get worse and worse and worse.
Dennis Hopper plays the hitman, obviously.
Yeah, Lyle.
Lyle, that's right.
Which is great. It's Dennis Hopper, like, right after, in the Blue Velvet period, so he's still Blue Velvety.
Everyone's casting him as kind of a crazy guy.
Yeah, we want you to be a crazy killer.
Yeah.
Go. And their interactions, just the two, Dennis Hopper and Nicolas Cage playing off of each other is kind of amazing to see, just because of how broad they can get on their own. And it's weird, they kind of focus each other. And Nicolas Cage, this is one of his more grounded roles. This isn't like a...
I would say it's when he still did grounded roles.
You're saying he doesn't do grounded roles anymore?
Not really.
All I can think of is the bees. No, the bees, the bees! Okay, so he was still doing grounded roles, and he's more grounded here. He's playing like the stone leveled noir hero who's just kind of put upon. And watching Dennis Hopper rip off of him is great. He's like just over the top Texan with his big belt buckle and his boots and his big Cadillac, and it's fun and dark, and it gets to really dark places. I mean, it ends up, there's a showdown in a cemetery. It's just a great film noir.
Awesome scenery, too. Is it in, like, Montana or Wyoming?
I want to say it's in Wyoming, but I know they filmed in Montana and Arizona.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But
just huge, wide
open. Yeah, wide open spaces, which is weird. It's, like, antithetical to what you think of when you think of film noir. You don't think of the open range, but it works really well.
Yeah, it does.
And, like, just, I mean, lots of bars and train cars and dark rooms and back alley meetings. It's interesting.
Yeah. But again, those are all this involves crime, but it goes to the point of the feeling, because those are all artifacts of noir. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then you've got the wide open spaces, and mm-hmm. you've got a guy, you know, being pushed to his limit. It's just an overall feeling of a guy going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And it's great. This is definitely one for all you dumb, stupid Nicolas Cage haters.
Wow. Okay. Whoa.
I am calling you out. Watch Red Rock West. Watch Raising Arizona.
Say Red Rock West 5 times
Red Rock,
fast.
Yeah, Red Rock West. We can say once at the same time. So. But yeah, no, I am calling them out because Nicolas Cage is great and he is awesome in this.
I've always thought he was great. I think all he needs is a really good director, I think, to kind of control
him. Well, it's just, and he does a lot too. It's, but when he hits, he hits hard.
Yes,
I
agree.
Yeah. So for my number 5, I'm just going to go. So that was both your number 5s, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So for number 5, classic. I just wanted to get it out of the way in case I feel like I felt like this was a case where somebody was like, oh, somebody else is going to put it on there, and then no one was going to put it on, so I'll bring it up. Everybody's thinking about it. Chinatown, right?
It was in honorable mentions.
I'm not doing detective movies.
Okay.
Honorable mention.
But yeah, okay. I love this movie.
I just figured we should talk about it. It's you know, it's a really good film noir.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of Jack Nicholson's best. I really enjoyed him at this age. He would just, I mean, I enjoy him all the time, but this
Jack
is
Nicholson
my favorite.
Jack Nicholson in the 70s was amazing.
Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
He's right at that point where he can start playing like a world-weary kind of guy.
Exactly. And, I mean, everybody's amazing in this. And Roman Polanski, who would have thought this dude would have made such a classic film like this? And I don't know.
I don't know what you mean by that.
He
made Rosemary's Baby.
He had made Rosemary's Baby, but it wasn't. Just seeing like the films he had made, like the other one, the previous to that was the Vampire, right? The Vampire Hunter one.
The Vampire Hunter, Knife in the Water.
Yeah.
This was also a very weird.
I forgot about that.
This was also like, a very weird time
Repulsion.
For Roman Polanski.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry, guys. I totally fucking forgot about that. Oh my god.
Yeah.
This was also a very weird time for Roman Polanski.
Yes, it
yes,
was.
Yes. Maybe that's the that's the case.
I say weird for Roman Polanski. It's more
weird
for
the lady
girl that he.
Yeah.
But raped. I totally forgot about that. For some reason, I don't know why the fuck I was thinking of a different director.
You were just thinking of Fearless Vampire Hunters, and that's it.
Yes, because you know what? I just watched, I was rewatching The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Okay.
And I totally fucking, and they only mentioned this because they're talking about how, like, no one really wanted it for stuff. And anyway, but this is one of my favorites. Life in the Water is pretty cool, but this is one of my favorite Polanski movies and Polanski noir films. And I think everybody—it's just so great to see like all the people that are in it. You know, like Faye Dunaway, John Huston.
Yeah, Faye Dunaway's awesome.
I love John Huston as an actor.
Yes,
you know, like,
he's
a great
so
director.
Creepy in this,
but yes, he's an amazing actor as well. But
and it gets dark with Faye Dunaway.
Yes, it does. Dark. It's funny, like just like how they just went there. Do you know what I mean like how they got really brave. And you really don't see that today, unless you watch Old Boy.
She's my daughter.
Old Boy. but yeah.
A little bit on another film on my list.
Oh, really?
That's just a teaser.
Oh, really? All right. Well, I'm glad I got out of the way. I'm glad no one put it on because I figured it was going to be the case where everyone thought, I don't know, mention.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is one of those movies. I feel like any book about film noir is going to have it mentioned at some point, and any book about screenwriting.
Yeah, and that's also the reason I also wanted to bring it up, for the fact that it's just so, like, when they talk about, oh, you know, by the book, this is a book they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the script they're talking about, you know, and it's just, anytime you're making a noir film, that's who I would go to. I'm like, okay, well, let's look at the script of Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and on every level, like, you know, character development, their spines, everything, like, it's screenwriting 101. You just read this,
revealing character via description, not via what they're saying.
Yes.
I love the scene, the first scene where he's showing the guy the pictures of him and his wife.
Yeah.
He opens the cabinet to get him some booze, and he goes and he hesitates and he grabs the cheap booze instead of the expensive booze and pours. Tells you everything you need to know.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So there it is, number 5. Got out of the way. Chinatown. Let's do this.
Well, most of my list is pretty obvious stuff. So my number 4 is from 1951, and it's Strangers on a Train.
Oh, you bastard. That was my number 1.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm saving that. That's honorable mention, but I'm saving something else.
That's for my list of movies that have something to do with a train.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot that's coming up, that list.
Yep.
I love this movie. This is one of my favorite Hitchcocks.
Goddamn, this movie's good.
His way of visually telling a story is amazing. And Robert Walker is creepy as hell.
Oh my God.
As Bruno.
The scene with the balloon and the little girl.
Yes.
It's just so amazing.
That whole scene. And then when I was rewatching this week, it brought me, cause we were talking about this a lot when we watched Shame.
Yeah.
And how actors being able to express a lot without saying anything. And there's that scene right there where he's following her and they're just exchanging looks. It says so much from him and then what she wants in the scene and what he wants in the scene.
Then he just takes a cigarette and just pops the balloon. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, that one shot just from far, that really long shot where he's like on the steps of the Capitol building and he's just sitting there staring at it and you really can't see anything. It's just his outline, basically. It's so creepy because it just comes out of nowhere and you're like, what the hell is this guy doing? But yeah, I love this movie and it really just explores the psychology of how crazy people can be.
And the scene, it's the first scene on the train with him and Farley Granger.
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite names for an actor. It's just, it's tense, but you don't know why.
Yeah.
Like it's just, it's a wide shot of the two of them in the train. So you feel like something's going to happen, but it's, you know, it's Walker bringing up, you know, the things, well, you know, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, and it's for those who don't know, it's about a guy who has an idea to, you know, each of them has a problem with somebody. I can't remember who Farley Granger, it's his
mom. It's his wife. Cause he met, so he's been kind of like separated from his wife.
And it's Robert Walker's mother. That's yes. right. And
he's like, no, father.
Father. And
you're thinking of Throw Mama from the Train.
Oh.
Sorry. That's my number one. Sorry. Never mind.
It's Bruno's father, right?
Yes.
And then the other guy's not wife. It's
they're
like
not
his
divorced.
Lover.
But it's his wife, but he wants to get married to this other woman.
The socialite, right?
Yeah. And so they decide to switch to trade murders.
Yeah.
And so he'll kill, you know, his wife and then he'll kill his father. But he, you know, only one of them
goes through.
Is under the impression that it's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it just goes on.
Guess
from
which
there.
One?
Yeah. And it is great. It is one of my favorite Hitchcocks.
Yeah. It's so good.
I like
it. It was on the other day.
On what?
On for Labor Day.
Oh, really?
It was on at the barbecue I was at, and it was on in the background. I'm like, I'm trying to pay attention to what you're saying, but Train is on the train. It's on right behind you.
I like watching Bruno and. Like some of the things he says are really funny, but because how uncomfortable like you are, like you like, I want to laugh. I just want to laugh because this guy's creepy.
That is the best.
Yes,
that's my favorite thing. Like that's as close as you can get to describing it. But that's one of my favorite things is when someone, it's that in combination with someone having all the power in a scene and like knowing everything, just like giving out little pieces and being very, you know. It being very confident about it, like it's hard to describe it, but yes, that is one of my very favorite things.
Where you're like, it's really uncomfortable. I'm gonna laugh. Where this guy's funny.
It's just so depraved. All you can do is laugh. It's hilarious.
Yeah, good fucking pick. And it's your number one, Brandon.
My number one.
Excellent, Adam.
Alrighty, my number four is.
What year is it from? Let's see. Let's see if everyone's taking.
1947.
Nope.
Number four, 1947. That would be The Lady from Shanghai.
Oh.
I don't even know where to start with this movie. It's so much fun. It's very dark. It's another man in the wrong place at the wrong time movie. He's not a detective. He's just a longshoreman who falls for the wrong femme fatale. I remember they...
I think they're all the wrong femme fatale.
some of them need love, okay? Orson Welles directing and starring. Wait, right? He's directing this one, isn't he? I believe so. Because he was getting in trouble. Because they were bugging him. They kept bugging him about his accent. His accent, the Irish accent that he wanted to use. I've heard that it's completely redubbed over. Like
really?
From the accent that it was originally.
Really,
I've heard a rumor, but I mean, I've never investigated it further. As much as I love this movie, I should.
Who's that guy that gets hired to overdub Orson Welles?
I don't know. Well, I mean, maybe they had him redo it himself. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
But just so many iconic moments in this movie, like when you see I see the shot of Orson Welles holding the gun, like down low in the frame, and like someone's up high above him. I see that in film noir books a lot. I don't remember if it was him or Hitchcock who says that the more important an object is, the bigger it should be in the frame. Anyone else familiar with that?
Mm. Yeah, I think that might have been
Hitch.
Sounds like Hitchcock.
Yeah. And then just, I mean, the last scene in the funhouse, the only thing better than watching the last scene of this movie in the funhouse is watching the last scene of this movie in the background of Manhattan Murder Mystery. When Woody Allen makes a joke about life imitating art, because they do literally the same thing with like all the mirrors. Rita Hayworth is great. Oh, there was another thing he got in trouble for. He dyed Rita Hayworth's hair blonde. They were married at the time. And then he's just got his regular coterie of actors. I can't, like, whose names I can't remember off the top of my head anymore. Glenn Anders as George Grisby is just weird and bizarre with his creepy little smile all the time when he's trying to get Orson Welles' character Michael O'Hara to pretend to kill him. It's such a weird, fun, dark movie. Just bizarre. It's like the most elaborate case of faking someone's death to get money, and it's very bizarre and fun. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out.
Well, cool. I have nothing to add to that. Do you?
No.
Then give us your number four.
My number four. Okay, my number four is a tie.
Whoa. Cheating.
I think I know. I know. But they both came out in the same year, and they both kind of ignited a thing. Nah, that's bullshit. It's Brick and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Those are my ties.
Well, I want to know what your bullshit was.
Okay. Well.
Well.
wait. I'll give you the tiebreaker. Brick is my number four. So.
Brick is your number four. Okay.
Yeah.
Brick is the one that's definitely a noir because.
Yeah.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is totally a neo-noir.
But I think you could make the argument that it's not. I agree. I totally agree. I would think out of everything we're discussing, though, you could probably put Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in just a fun mystery as opposed to a noir. Because it's not particularly dark.
It's pretty dark. Incest. Suicide.
There's a lot of these lists with incest. Yeah. Incest is a big...
Yeah.
Incest is more prevalent in noir than I first realized.
It's a big taboo, and so it's an easy get.
That's true.
Yeah.
But it's fun. Well, it's fun incest.
I don't know about all that. The movie is fun. The movie is fun.
Yeah.
I still...
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a lighthearted film noir.
Yeah. I still, everywhere we go, if I see someone who looks like somebody, I will do some variation on there's a Native American Joe Pesci.
Well, it's for a film noir, it's lighthearted, but it's a really dark comedy.
It's a very dark comedy.
Yeah.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is one of my favorite movies of the past 10 or 15
years.
Yeah,
I feel
like
it comes up a lot on this podcast and for good reason.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
And it is great.
If you still haven't seen it, you should go watch it,
especially if you plan on seeing Iron Man 3.
If you like, Shane Black. If you like Robert Downey Jr., you have this to thank for it because this made him, you know, budgetable again.
Yeah,
and Brick, you know, Rian Johnson launched his career.
Yeah,
and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Joseph Gordon-Levitt would not be in everything he's in if it wasn't for Brick.
Yeah, I feel like this was his like. Well,
this
I
guess what about
Mysterious
Skin?
Skin. Skin. Mysterious Skin.
Mysterious Skin, really.
But I feel like Mysterious Skin was...
You guys know what Mysterious Skin is.
Yes. But I feel like Mysterious Skin was more... it wasn't so mainstream because of the context of the movie. You know what I mean? Like what the themes are. And,
That's why it isn't mainstream.
Yeah.
And Brick was on hold for a while just because it had a lot of production issues. So...
Yeah. But I feel like this is the movie that kind of like, hey, this guy's not a kid actor anymore. This guy's an adult actor.
Yeah.
And he's fucking serious.
And this is Rian Johnson saying, I want to make a noir. Like, I just want to make a noir. So how do I make a noir?
Yeah.
And he films it at his high school and makes it about high school students.
Yeah.
And obviously my favorite part, but the thing people discuss most about Brick is probably the language. Mm-hmm. That is used in Brick, like the weird stunted, you know, vocabulary of the world of Brick.
Yeah.
Which is it takes a little bit. Like it took me a little bit to get into the flow of it. But it's great. And then I've been vamping trying to think of the name who plays the pin.
Oh,
Lucas
Haas. Yes. He's great.
Well, first off, this is my favorite Rian Johnson movie by a lot. far and above everything else that I've seen of his.
All right.
His episode of Breaking Bad.
Just putting that out
there. What you have seen and not seen.
Yes.
You've seen his episode of Breaking Bad.
I have seen his episode of Breaking
Bad.
It's
awesome.
It is good. Still not as good as Brick.
No.
But better than a movie that's not out yet. But what's your name? Who's the girl, the femme fatale? In
Nora Zahetner.
Yeah, she's really good.
She's really good in Heroes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
She's really good. She plays a really good femme fatale and just
the music. I love the music in this.
Yeah,
movie.
The music's awesome.
Cinematography
is great. I heard they had a lot of problems with the sound. That was part of the reason it took a while for it to come out.
It was his first big movie.
That just random factoid, a complaint. I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
But with sound, I love what he does in some of the scenes where he enhances the sound. Like there's that one chase scene where he really enhances
the shoes.
And it's all for the impact of what happens. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's clearly a fan of film noir. He studied it very well and he delivered, as far as I'm concerned, a pitch perfect neo-noir homage to film noir.
And I think
Days Gone By.
This is a good example of what I was trying to say earlier about someone who is a big fan of noir, who understands like what made, you know, what people consider the great noirs, you know, successful, what made them work. It all translates into the feeling you have watching it. And so if you get that, I feel like you're going to be more, if you're a filmmaker, if you are, you know, if that's what you do, you are going to be more successful in translating that into something else and making a noir, as opposed to other genres or styles.
My problem with that argument, though, in this case, is just because of what else I've seen of his, I feel like the tenets of film noir are so strong, a filmmaker can kind of use it as a crutch to make them look better than they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but you're talking about other films Ryan Johnson has made.
If you're an okay filmmaker, but you have a really good understanding of film noir is strong enough to where it can, the tenets of film noir, if you use them correctly, can make your film
can
elevate your film.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas if you take those away, your film, you're not necessarily making as good a film.
Let's not beat around the bush. You're talking about Looper. That's what you're talking about.
I was talking about Brothers Bloom also. I don't think Brothers Bloom is very good either.
Well, I don't think that's noir either.
Yeah. No, it's not. That's what I'm saying. You take away...
Right. Well, I guess what I'm talking about specifically with noir, like, let's say... What I'm saying, I think, is there's common... And everyone who enjoys a noir or great noir movies all have common ground with what they like about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like other genres maybe where someone finds a particular thing very cool and they latch onto that, like horror does, you know, where it's, you know, they love ghost stories or,
right.
You know,
no, I'm agreeing
or heaven
with that
hell
part.
Stuff. Yeah.
I'm saying that common ground is so strong that it elevates the movie and it's like, oh, this is really good.
It does. That's okay. Yes.
When you take it away, it's like, oh, well, you're good. But without the strong elements of this specific genre to bolster you,
well,
you
but
kind
then,
of
but
waffle.
Then we're just having a discussion about how you feel about Ryan Johnson.
Yeah,
that's,
I guess so.
That's what I was doing. I was having a discussion about Ryan Johnson. I was saying that I feel like he's an okay filmmaker who really loves film noir, and that helped make a really good movie. But once he moved beyond that, it's suffered.
Yeah,
back me up here.
I agree.
Well, here's the thing.
I don't agree with what you're saying, but I know why you're saying it, and I agree with that.
I mean, I see what you're saying, but the problem is I enjoy 80% of Brothers Bloom. I'm not a fan. I hate the ending, and I think that is what ruined the movie, but I enjoy a lot of that movie. Looper, there were elements of the movie I definitely enjoyed, but as a movie as a whole, I was like, oh, it was okay.
Right.
So I definitely see what you're saying. And yeah, Brick is the strongest film, and maybe it is because of the film noir elements that makes it better. And maybe he is just an average filmmaker, and he happened to harness the brilliance of film noir so well that he made a great movie. And then when he stepped away and tried to do something else, he just didn't understand the elements enough where he just made an okay movie, or at least with Brother Bloom, a really good movie until the ending, and then it just became okay.
And it's not like I hate Ryan Johnson. I just want to put that out there. I just feel like Brick is above and beyond everything else that he's made.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just am trying to separate the conversation about Rian Johnson from the conversation about my quote-unquote theory of noir or idea about noir. Because I think they're two separate conversations.
Well, your theory is what just gave me the epiphany about Rian Johnson. So it's your fault. I just want to put that out there. Well, that and you right. brought booze. So
yeah. Well, just, let's just say Brick...
Brick amazing, is amazing.
Amazing.
And it's an excellent pick.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed
Brother really
Bloom.
Is.
I salute you, and I am really looking forward to Looper.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That is that is my number four as well. So,
wait, you. Was Brick?
Yeah.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Common ground. We have all had similar choices in our top five.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
If I was doing detective, or if I was including detective movies, Brick would have most definitely been on this list.
Okay, so my number three is from 1946, and it's The Killers.
That's a good one.
I remember the first time I watched this movie, I was like, this movie, I went out and bought the Criterion DVD because I loved it so much, and I knew I would rewatch it over and over and over again.
In talking about film noir, I feel like one of the main tenets of film noir is they all seem to grab you with the opening.
Yes.
They're really good at grabbing you with the opening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the opening of this movie, you're just like, you're hooked. The way he sets up these two killers that come into just town and the way they handle the situation, I feel almost like Cronenberg maybe got a little bit of a feeling from this movie when he made History of Violence, just setting up those two characters, because it has that feel in the beginning of this movie. These two guys come in, and they're very freaking scary guys, and then when you see them later, you're just like, oh, shit, shit's going to get real. And then also the way they kind of set up the suite and how he just... Because the way the movie opens is these two killers come into a small town and they're there to kill this guy called the Swede. And he kind of just lets it happen. Someone warns him that it's going to happen. He's like, I don't care. And he just lies in his bed. And he just lets himself be gunned to death by these guys. I mean, I think they shot him like 6 times. And so an insurance investigator has to investigate a claim because he's giving his life insurance. It's like $2,500 that he's giving this like tenant to a... like a halfway house. And so he needs to investigate why this is going on. He wants to figure out why these guys came into town. So this insurance investigator goes out and tries to figure out why, what was going on with the Swede and why did these guys want to kill the Swede. And the Swede is played by Burke Lancaster and he's amazing. Another awesome performance is from Ava Gardner playing Kitty Collins as the femme fatale. And just kind of the way the story goes and how you're trying to figure out how the Swede ended up here because he was a boxer and he was a good boxer at one point. And how did he end up at this one point where these two guys come into town and just want to shoot him? And kind of just how, where the story goes. And the very end, when everything comes together, you're like, holy crap. It really just pulls out the twists and turns and you just go on this great ride and it gets very dark and you feel really bad for the Swede for the entire movie, for most of the movie. And you just see him as a guy that kind of just gets played, and it's really good.
It's anyone new to film noir, if you're reading about it, it's probably one of the first movies that, like I think, like most of your list so far, you're mentioning the first movies that come up. Like, oh, well, these are the cream of the crop of film noir.
Yes,
during the day.
Yeah,
back in the day.
Yeah, that's my list.
It's
my whole list.
It's a great movie. So well, I know what's on the rest of your list then.
Yeah. Adam?
We're moving on right away?
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, then, my number... What number am I on? Three?
Three.
Okay. So my number three is from 1945, and it's Detour.
Another assuming the role.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Hitchhiker who gets a ride with a guy. The guy dies, and he assumes his role. And then he gets into trouble with the law a couple of times, thanks to a femme fatale. Who saw that one coming?
I didn't see it coming at all.
Part of the reason I love this movie is because of how indie it is. It's a very low budget. It was I can't remember the name of it, but it was like one of the lesser studios. They had a particular name for the lesser studios back in the day. And it's not
the
very
teenies.
Long.
Hmm? The teenies.
The teenies. Not quite. Something, something row. If I was thinking clearly, I could probably remember, but I can't remember. It's simple. you can see how small their budget was, especially in like the bigger scene. Like there's a dance hall scene, but there's an intimacy to this movie, which is weird for what year it is. It's like 1945. It kind of reminds me of Cassavetes, like before Cassavetes. It's fun. Dark. The way that he accidentally kills someone is kind of ridiculous to me. Like, you see it coming. You've seen this one, right, Brandon?
Or everyone else? Haven't.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Have. You've seen Detour? Yeah. The way he accidentally kills somebody.
Yes.
And you see it coming, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's so good. And you just feel so bad for this guy. And, of course, he's doomed, you know, from the get-go. It's a film noir. He does something he shouldn't do, so he's going to take shit for it for the rest of the movie. But it's just so much fun. And I think it's Anne Savage, yeah, as Vera. And she just rides him straight to hell. Like, she's on him all the way, dogging him and just constantly bitching at him. And she's really good and, like, relishing in it. She reminds me of Norma Desmond from Sunset Boulevard. She's great. And who's Tom Neal as Al Roberts. And it's just, again, another poor schlub in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's in public domain, so you can watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
You can watch it on Netflix.
That's true.
Probably watch it on Amazon.
You can make copies of it.
You can make copies of it.
It's totally legal.
Do your own thing.
Yeah. Make your own remake of it. Whatever you want. It's in public domain.
You could do a live reading of it.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
And then...
That's the worst.
I believe we're at number
Detour?
Three.
Yeah.
Number Detour three. Was my number
yeah.
three.
Okay. My number three? The Grifters.
I was really debating about putting this on this list.
Somebody brought this up, like, just recently.
About what?
What did you say? The Grifters?
The Grifters, yeah.
With John Cusack?
John Cusack.
Angelica Houston.
Somebody just brought this up, like, a couple episodes ago, didn't they?
Maybe actresses, Angelica Houston.
Yeah,
maybe.
Brandon brought it up for Angelica Houston.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah. She is awesome in this.
Yes.
This is kind of an incest thing, maybe. It's not...
They have a weird close relationship,
and she uses that maybe not he has feelings towards her because maybe not she's his mother. Like,
and,
I mean, she is,
and
maybe not
Annette Bening's character, who he is sleeping with, slightly resembles her.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But no, this movie's awesome. I love how crazy Annette Bening is in it.
Yeah, yes. It took me a long time to get around to watching this movie, not that long. I probably watched it earlier than I should have still, but I was in a different head. Like, I didn't read what it was about. I just saw that John Cusack was in it, and on the cover, they look a little bit happier than they maybe should.
Yeah,
really not expecting how dark this movie gets.
Yeah, it is much, much darker than – yeah, I was in the same boat when I first saw it, but it was – yeah, the material is
– I mean, you get to the ending, and it's like a – it's like you just ran a mile or something. You're just like, what just happened? Like, you're drained and you're just kind of out of it. And like, what just happened? I wasn't, if you don't know what it is, if you hadn't watched a trailer or read about it and you just a blind rental, it can take you by surprise, especially once you get to the end. Well, I mean, I feel like it sneaks in a couple sucker punches before, like the scene where with the, is it oranges where she, they put something in the bag and hits her with it. Angelica Houston. Do you remember that scene?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or when John Cusack gets hit in the gut with a baseball bat.
Oh, at the beginning?
Yeah.
When he's pulling the Yeah.
It's an interesting movie.
Yeah, and it's a con movie. I would say you would call it a noir.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's a neo... Are we saying neo-noir, new noir,
yeah,
modern noir?
Whatever you want to say. There's
okay.
no...
Stephen Frears.
Yeah. Stephen Frears.
I love, I feel like every movie geek probably loves the elevator shot.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite shots ever.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a
and
bold
it's
statement.
Really simple. It's just simple and visual storytelling itself so much. And like I got, because I remember going back and listening to the commentary and I got exactly what he was, like he says what he was trying to go for. And like, okay, yeah, I got that. Perfect. Well done. It's great to me.
The Grifters from 1993. Excellent.
Wait, this one's 90, isn't it?
90, yeah. Sorry, Red Rock West was 93.
Okay.
This is 90.
All right, so we're at three?
Two.
Oh, really?
You're at three.
I picked from 2000. I picked Memento as my number three. I think it's well, I'm waiting for that. For my number one, I think I may get a no, but we'll see. But I think this is a film noir.
It's a film noir in reverse.
Yeah. And the thing is, I feel like
the ending is great. The opening sucks.
I feel like every one of Christopher Nolan's movies is a film noir. I don't know if you guys feel the same way.
I don't.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
What don't you? Which one?
Well, I would ask you. So, well, let's stick with the popular Christopher Nolan. So you're saying the Batmans are noirs?
Well, I think Batman is closer to a noir than
Inception for sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I mean, okay. Batman
Inception is not. I would not call Inception.
Yeah,
noir
Inception's not a noir to me at all.
All right, I'll give you that one.
But Batman is inherently noirish to me.
Yes.
So you might be
especially
you
like
might
Batman
be bringing,
Begins.
You might be bringing that to Batman.
Yeah.
But I don't.
The Prestige.
But see, I don't.
There's not a noir. When I see those movies, I don't think noir.
No, I don't get that feeling. I don't get a feeling of dread at all.
Well, see, not the noir feeling of. I mean, it's.
Generally, in noir, there are no heroes.
Right.
There is no one saving the day. Generally. In a noir, right?
I don't know.
There's not a lot of winning going on.
Well, I mean, there are people saving. There are people trying. There might be people trying to do something good, but
yeah.
But it never ends well. I feel like that's a tenet. Like it shouldn't end well for the protagonist if it's a film noir.
Right, and Batman is a hero.
Yeah,
he will win. Mm-hmm. He will win in the end.
Does he?
Yes, every time.
All right.
When does he not?
That's another conversation. I guess so.
When does
but
he not win?
Well, wouldn't you? But okay, let's just say they're not doing. But I feel like he's really heavy influenced by noir. There's a lot of like heavy influence, even in Inception. Like,
I think the influence of noir extends only to the surface level of things being dark and maybe a bit slower.
I don't agree.
A little
with
more
that.
Dreadful.
I don't agree with that.
Okay,
well, I think it's a little more.
Come back.
Well, it's just. I don't know. I just feel like. Well, starting with Memento. Well, let's talk about Memento first.
Memento, I would agree with.
I would agree
with you on Memento. I'm not agreeing with you on the Batman movies.
Really? Okay. Well, at least Batman Begins. You got to give me that. It's basically a detective story, kind of. Like, I mean, Batman is a detective.
We're getting more into Batman territory, but he is barely a detective in Nolan's Batman movies.
I agree with that. That's one of my biggest problems with Nolan's Batman movies.
Barely a detective.
Well, actually, technically,
in Dark Knight, even Dark Knight,
with all the Batman films, he's barely
a
detective.
You're right.
He's more of a detective in Batman the Animated Series than he is.
He's more of a detective in like Batman and Robin than he is in any of Nolan's Batman movies.
Wait, the movie?
Yeah,
or the old serial?
Well,
because the serial. If you went Batman and Robin the serial, that could be on your film noir list.
I guess so. They're literally solving crime.
Yes.
Yeah. There's no.
They're not fighting crime. They're solving it in the serials. Yeah. Okay.
And if we're talking about archetypes of noir, there's no femme fatale.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in the new one,
there's no mistake. There's no mistaken identity.
I don't think. All right. I feel like I'm gonna have.
If we're talking about the straight
artist number one,
of noir.
With the number one,
I think I'm in the middle. I'm like on the fence between the I don't. It's not completely film noir, but I can see influence. But I don't think that it's a tradition. I don't think
This makes it sound like I think they're more poorly made than they are. But I think they're as noir as like a bad student filmmaker is making a noir thing, where he's like, oh, I'm going to go into like an abandoned warehouse and it's going to be really dark and we're just going to put three lights.
Why are you going to talk about my movie? And everyone,
I thought I started. Okay. Here's the thing. I've never actually seen it. I've only seen shots of it.
I didn't go into
and I thought
warehouse.
It was a parking garage. Was it a parking garage?
I'm sure. I think they'll be filming a parking garage.
But you know what I mean, right? It's just I'm going to cut everyone in half with a shadow. I'm going to put a gun in someone's hand and a hot dame, you know, because you're going to say dame because you've seen all things. That makes it sound like I feel like the Batman movies are more poorly made than they are. But I feel like it's that, if you're going to say they're noir, I feel like it's that level of of artifice of noir in the Batman movies.
All right, I'll give you that. Yeah, I'll take it.
I mean, they remind me more of, and I mean, this is intentionally so because he was influenced by them, but they're, and the Michael Mann crime dramas, which are noir, which are closer to noir than this for me, but still.
Well, let's not talk about Michael Mann because he might be number one. All right. Memento. I love it. It's very simple.
Yeah, guys, Memento's great.
Looking to solve the who killed his wife.
Femme fatale.
There's a femme fatale. The story's told out of order, backwards. And it's great. It's and on top of the fact that he doesn't have any short-term memory.
Well, okay, and this one does have clear elements of
noir.
It's got the doomed hero.
I'm not arguing.
Cannot succeed. Oh no, I'm. Yeah, no, I'm just agreeing okay. with him. I know you're not arguing on this one.
Yeah,
but the doomed hero, who you like, even if he wins, he doesn't.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's an investigator.
Yeah.
But again, I think it all comes back to that doom, which is like there is no real victory for him.
There's never any escape.
Yeah.
You never feel like there's light at the end of
right.
the tunnel.
And that's okay. That's another, okay, coming back to Batman. As dark as they are, there's still that hope in them. Because, like, he's trying to be better, and there's hope. There's a message of hope. Where this one, it's like, no matter what, you're fucked.
You know that it's darkest just before the dawn, right?
I do.
That time when the sun's coming up and it's actually kind of bright out?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that is my number three. Let's go on to the number two. Bam. Kevin.
Okay. So my number one and two, I've been all week just trying to decide which one to do, and it took me a while to figure it out. My number two is very obvious. It's probably in the top five, probably some lists, and number one on a lot of lists. It's from 1950, and it's Sunset Boulevard.
Damn you.
Everyone always says that. I never think of it as a noir.
Really?
Yeah, it totally. It I would say it totally is, but I just never think of it. Like, if you say make a list of noir movies, Sunset Boulevard would never come to mind for some reason. But I would totally agree that it is.
It's just weird to me that it doesn't come to mind.
Yeah,
I think it was the first thing that came to mind when we said this list. I was like, oh, Sunset Boulevard.
It's tied for my number one.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have any good reason why not.
I mean,
maybe it's its status. As more of like one of the great movies ever made.
Right.
It's never generally put in the
it's
category
also,
of noir.
I feel it approaches noir from a much different angle than normal, where it's a much smaller, like it's about crime, but very much like after the fact. Is that like the crime comes into it very late in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there at the beginning, but it's not really a part of the story until
the end.
Everything's done and over with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got all the elements, like the dark elements. It's got the doomed hero and just, it's the vibe. It's got the noir vibe
totally.
To it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is like when you line it up with other noir movies, it sticks
out. And that's good. It's just,
it
feels different.
Out.
Yeah. Especially at the time.
Yeah.
It's
and Billy Wilder. I feel like if it had, you know about the original opening, right?
No.
The original opening was supposed to be in the morgue, and the bodies are talking to each other from the beyond.
Interesting.
And I feel like if it had that, I feel like that would have taken it to a different realm.
I don't like
realm
that. Yeah.
Beyond. Well, yeah. The audiences were laughing.
Yeah.
The test audience.
That's the first thing you see is two corpses talking to each other.
Well, it's like they're wheeling him in. I think you're following the sirens, and they wheel him in, and they stop on him, and he starts talking, and like. Each corpse talking about how they died.
Like
and audiences were laughing at it.
Yeah, I like that idea, but
not
for this
That's
movie.
A weird opening for Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really cool idea, though.
Yeah.
But
you should pitch that to what's his. No, it's the guy.
That guy.
No.
But yeah, it's in this weird category by itself for me. Just the way it's so much more involved in the industry and this one person's psychoses than it is about the criminal underworld.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that when I was doing the list, I was really looking at films that more explore the psychoses of the characters, like the real, like the psychology of.
Oh, that was another thing that's big. And of course, the most obvious one that we would like Freudian psychology was a big thing where everyone was talking about duality and everyone was big on Freud right then. Oh, well, Freud said this. Let's put it in the movie somewhere.
Yeah. And and kind of the way that Gloria Swanson just embodies that in that character and just really exploring that character that's kind of just fallen out of the limelight, who used to be this huge star and still believes she is, and kind of just how that just drives her mad.
Yeah. Well, Norma Desmond is just a fascinating character.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything more sad than her in that movie.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Just from the get-go.
Burying her monkey.
Yes. Yeah. So now I'm curious, what the fuck is your number one? Now I'm curious. All right. Adam?
All right. My number two is from 1981, and it's Body Heat.
Ooh. I was wondering if somebody was going to put that on here.
Oh,
yeah. I knew you were going to put it on there.
I got to put Body Heat on. Oh, it's so good. I love... again, this is Lawrence Kasdan clearly loves film noir. He just does it so well and just makes it like the sexiest it's ever been. Well, damn near the sexiest. Kathleen Turner and William Hurt are amazing in this movie. I mean, Lawrence Kasdan, his script is great. Again, the sort of wrong man, wrong place, getting into a situation he shouldn't be in. I don't even know where to start with this movie. There's so many great things going on. The supporting cast is great. It's just all around a great movie. I love the relationship between William Hurt and Ted Danson. Well, okay, first off, great character name, Ned Racine.
Yeah.
That's straight out of a pulp novel.
Yeah.
And just him getting involved with the wrong woman and just the depths he'll go to be with her. It's one of the best film fatales ever. And as I mentioned in the sex scene episode, yeah, one of the best sex scenes of all time.
Yeah. Good example of environment too, right?
Using the environment.
Yeah.
Well, the Florida.
Yeah.
The heat wave.
Just the heat. Like, yeah. Does. I think I wouldn't put on my list because it's not near as good, but Heaven's Prisoners, the book is a lot better than the movie, but
okay,
but just that everyone's always sweating, like it's all, it's like you're trapped in the environment.
Yeah, you can feel it. It's the film is so good that you can feel it. You can feel the heat in the movie where it's just
on your body.
It's
body.
The heat is on your body.
Yeah. But like in Red Rock West, where it's the opposite, it's wide open, like almost colder, but you feel trapped in the expanse of it.
Yeah.
Like you're just alone in this, you're just isolated in this giant expanse of land. And then you've got, you know, Florida humid heat or Heaven's Prisoners, New Orleans. And it's just like you're trapped.
Yeah. And you can't escape it. And you don't know what's going to happen. And then the whole element of fire and a classic film noir tenant murdering the husband for the insurance money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great one.
I dig. Again, good sex scene.
Did the insurance, this may be the modern tip, but did the insurance industry ever like take umbrage in film noir? That's a big plot of a lot of noir.
It is
insurance money.
Yeah.
Like, did they ever campaign against anything?
I don't recall it coming up in any of my readings on film noir.
Yeah, okay.
They're like, well, we don't like this trend, guys.
Yeah, well, people fight against everything now, so I was just thinking, at some point, maybe some insurance agency, State Farm or something in 1943, was like...
Well, I feel like, if anything, it just gave them more cause to investigate. It's like, well, this reminds me a lot of this part of this movie, so I'm going to have to... I highly doubt that you really deserve your insurance money. I suspect foul play.
My husband died in a car crash. Who's your boyfriend?
And what's the name of your boyfriend?
Ned Racine.
So we are to...
Number two?
Two.
Two?
Two.
I felt like someone was going to have this. Blade Runner.
I took it off my list.
You took it off your list?
Before we started.
Blade Runner?
Yeah.
I had to put Blade Runner on.
It wouldn't... I mean, it's. I like it. Don't love it. I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry.
What? I don't know what to say. So I guess we're even.
All right. It's no alien.
No, it's no Alien, but I would not call Alien noir.
Well, no. No, this is definitely noir.
Yeah, this is definitely
noir. I will not argue that at all.
Definitely noir. Yeah. You know, it is, you could say it's more of a detective story.
Yeah. It's a noir detective story. But I would never argue that Blade Runner is not a noir. I totally agree it's and noir. It plays, it's just not one of my favorites.
And it you know, being science fiction, it plays on identity in a very weird way.
I feel like that was my... Later on in life, I mean, earlier on, it's like, oh, well, Harrison Ford's in it, so I'll see it. But later on, like, I need to revisit it because it is so clearly an interesting variation of film noir, like sci-fi film noir. It's the same reason Red Rock West is appealing to me, where it's a Western film noir.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see the way people play with the convention.
Mixing with the different genres.
Mixing genres,
Yeah. And I mean, things, you know, it's famous for a reason. I mean, outside of its film noiriness. The production design, the feel of everything, the cinematography.
There's scenes where like they're smoking, and it's like clearly like that's a shot out of like a like 50s movie, but it's in the future.
Mm-hmm. Like the scene, the epitome of it is the scene when he's coming home into his apartment, which is like this weird, you know, angular futuristic apartment, awesome production design, but you know it could be in any 40s or 30s noir movie. going back to the apartment, and he's looking over the video. You know, he could be looking over files. It's just, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. And Sean Penn is amazing. Rutger Hauer.
Edward James Olmos.
Edward James Olmos. Teardrops in the Rain.
Everyone in the movie, as far as I'm concerned, is great.
Yeah, everyone's great. I
don't know why. I'm just, I don't know what I don't know what it is about the movie where I'm just not like, I'm not gung-ho about it for some reason yet. I don't know. I have no idea why. Because I feel like I should be.
You got to watch the three different versions. The director's
cut. I saw it when they re-released it. I saw it on the big screen. I've seen it on the big screen.
Yeah, the narration's bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Which is interesting because that's a big tenet of noir.
It's a big tenet of noir.
Is having a narration.
Yeah.
One of my honorable mentions is a very good narration, but it might be on one of your lists. So I don't know if I'll mention it.
Well, we'll go down to my number two. I picked a movie from 1950, and it is Elie Kazan's first film. And I really enjoy this movie because it doesn't star.
And it's called.
It doesn't star anybody named Brando. It's called Panic in the Streets. And
Panic in the Streets.
It's about like a plague. They're breaking out.
Yeah, imagine you got what's the Soderbergh movie? I'm trying to blank.
Contagion.
Contagion, but in the 50s, and it's a noir. So it's basically this guy comes in from off the boats. He gets involved in there's a crime, and there's a
atomic
guy.
Power somehow causes a virus.
well, there's a virus coming. It comes in through the boats. But there's a detective and a doctor searching for this guy, but it's like a mistaken identity type of thing where the criminals think they're after them to bust them, but they're really there to contain that spread of this virus and stuff, and it's really cool. It's like it's very much like a confused. This guy's really confused. He thinks he's going to be charged for a crime. They just want to like quarantine him, and it's really well done because it's imagine Contagion. If it was a film noir, it's amazing.
I prefer to imagine Outbreak if it were a film noir.
Sure.
That's just my personal preference.
The monkey, half lit.
Or half the guy that plays Jimbo.
Smoking monkey.
Yes.
But yeah, this is a movie that, this is one of the movies that I would say like I would love to remake. Just because it's so cool. It's so small, but yet in some like scenes it's huge. Like they're in a train station, and it's I love it. It's a good movie, and it's
because it's outside of the noir discussion. But what is the disease in the movie?
You know what? I don't remember it. I know. Jack Palance is one of the guys that they're following.
He's got Jack Palance disease.
Jack Palance disease. He's always doing push-ups on the floor. I don't remember. I'm not gonna lie to you. I saw this when I was really young, but it's a movie that I really really love, and I hate that I don't own it. I think the Warner Archive just released it on DVD. It wasn't available for a long time.
Pneumonic plague?
Yeah.
That sounds like something made up.
Yeah.
Yep. I swear to God, I bet there's some throwaway line in the movie where it's atomic power, like, created caused some virus.
But it's one of Jack Palance's first films. So check that out. Number two.
I will.
Panic in the Streets, Eli Kazan's first movie. Go ahead.
Okay.
Recap it.
Was his first movie.
Yeah.
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 Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, recap. My number five was Laura, four Strangers on a Train, three The Killers, two Sunset Boulevard, and my number one is from 1950, and it's In a Lonely Place. I just really respond to this movie. It has one of my favorite actors of all time in one of his my favorite performances of his, and it's about a Hollywood screenwriter, and he has elements of madness, but it's also... So the storyline is somewhat big Hollywood screenwriter is asked to read this book, but he doesn't really feel like reading it. So he ends up meeting this coat check girl who read the book, and he brings her home to kind of describe the book to him to see if he wants to adapt it as a screenplay. Well, the next day, turns out after she left his apartment, the girl ends up getting strangled and killed. And so now he's the number one suspect. And it's really good because you don't know. I mean, there's that whole thing of unknown because the character of Dixon Steele he's a little crazy. There's this really brilliant scene, and the way that Nicholas Ray lights Humphrey Bogart in surrounded by darkness, but he's got this like almost like a spotlight on his face, and he's getting really excited about describing how the killer would have murdered this girl and had made her feel comfortable and then put his arm around her and then just slowly started strangling her with his arm. And he gets really excited talking about it. And it's very creepy. And it's kind of like, could Dixon Steele have murdered this girl? And it just leaves you with that question mark throughout the film. One thing that I really love in the movie is the writing, and specifically the writing of dialogue. It's got a line that I immediately responded to when I heard it, which is, there's no sacrifice too great for a chance at immortality. And it has lines throughout the movie that just really stick in your head like that. And I think that's why I ended up making my number one, is just because I just respond a little more to it, even though I love Sunset Boulevard so much. This movie, I respond to Bogart's performance, and I respond to the writing and the fact that he is a writer. And the love story itself, there's a love story in it because he ends up meeting this woman who witnessed him saying goodbye to the girl as he was leaving. And she was like, he didn't go home. She left his apartment after that. And so whatever happened after that happened, and these two end up falling in love, and the love story is great. And kind of how her suspicion of him builds throughout the movie is really interesting.
I've never seen this.
Yeah, I haven't. It's on my list, and I'm always presuming that I haven't picked it up yet, but now I really want to.
God, that's another great name, though. Dixon Steele.
Dixon Steele, yeah.
And the Nicholas Ray, writer, director of Rebel.cause, right?
Yeah, director, yep.
He might have written, too. I don't know. God damn it. Now I have to watch that. It sounds amazing.
I love it.
God damn it.
I feel like every time we do the podcast,
he's very adamant.
Good
about
movie
it.
I haven't seen.
Well, I feel like it's like the movies pile onto the list. Like, it's like, damn it. I thought I was like making a dent onto that list of movies to see, but no, another one.
The second you realize you'll never live long enough to see all the movies you want to see, it's
wait,
all
well,
great.
What?
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing with books.
I need another drink.
When you realize, like, oh man. Well, even if I started when I was like 18 and really kind of started comprehending, could I read all of Stephen King's books? And then you're like, probably not.
And then you think, wait a minute.
He wrote them.
Or I could read like classic great books.
But those Stephen King books, they're really easy to get through. Really, I think you could finish all of Stephen
Except
King's
for the
books.
Fact that like 17,000 pages.
They're quick reads.
Have you ever read The Stand?
I started it once.
Case closed. I read The Stand.
I read The Shining.
The Shining?
I read Carrie.
It was much shorter than The Stand. Stand was great, though. It sounds like I'm shitting on The Stand. The Stand was really great.
Yeah, no, you just shit on The Stand.
Damn you. All right, you're number one. Recap number one.
Okay. All right, so my number five was Red Rock West. My number four was Lady from Shanghai. And my number three was Detour. My number two was Body Heat. And my number one... I've got a tie, Sunset Boulevard, which I already mentioned, and Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
I was waiting for somebody to put it on there.
Got
to
do it. It's got to be done.
I figured that was a case like Chinatown, where it's like, yeah. We all, yeah, we want, yeah, to, we want to talk about something else.
Well, no, I want to talk about the death. Yeah. Well, let's talk about it, because it's, I'm glad someone put it on the list.
When I first got into film noir, I was given a copy of the book, or maybe took a copy of the book, In a Dark Place. It's this film noir reader. And the very first paragraph in that book is describing the introduction to Double Indemnity. And I mean, it is the film noir. As far as it's got the femme fatale, it's got the wrong man. It's got
Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck.
And Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah.
And technically, he is a detective, but he's not the main character. So whatever. The main character. So
you're okay with your own self-imposed roles. Okay.
Yes. it's just so good. And what, Billy Wilder, but Fred McMurray playing this dark, dark part. I feel like I'd seen this before I had seen The Apartment, where he's also playing kind of a douchebag.
You saw this before you saw The Apartment, you said?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. Because you're like, oh, I don't trust this guy. When is this guy going to kill Jack Lemmon?
What's his angle?
No, at the same time, it's Fred McMurray in those two movies is weird because, I mean, I grew up watching Nick at Night and watching My Three Sons all the time. Mm. So I feel like I got the same.
It was a triple freak out.
Yeah, I got
what is he doing to those children?
No. I was watching My Three Sons before I saw either of these movies. So I've got the intended reaction because I feel like he was cast against type in both of those movies.
Yeah.
So I was right along with him. Like, oh my gosh, Fred McMurray's the nice guy. He's playing this double-crossing, murdering philanderer.
Which is the perfect kind of setup for if you're doing a noir movie.
Yeah.
That's the best thing you could hope for is playing against expectations with the actor.
Yeah.
Because everyone's like, oh, yeah, he seems like
he's
a nice
the nice
guy.
Oh, yeah. Wait. He's going to try to kill that dude.
It's
guess what? For the insurance money.
Yes. Allstate? What do you have to say about this?
But it goes back. I mentioned Breaking Bad, but it's like with Bryan Cranston. Everyone knew Bryan Cranston as the goofball dad on Malcolm in the Middle. Yep. You put him in
The dentist from Seinfeld,
or the troublemaker. But and then play him against type in Breaking Bad, where he's just in a downward spiral, and it's the perfect setup.
You're just making me wish I was at home watching Breaking Bad right now.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, it's not fun. It's cool.
you can come watch Breaking Bad too.
My number one. Yeah.
Spanning time.
Spanning time. I don't even know what else to say.
What is there to say? It's badass.
It's Double Indemnity. Go watch Double Indemnity.
Go see it. Yes, twice. Go watch it.
It's from Raymond Chandler. What are you gonna do?
Raymond Chandler, Billy Wilder, Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck. The great visuals. It's some of the special features on the DVD. It's got some of the most interesting documentaries just about the visuals and like all they did to put all the sawdust and whatnot in the air to make it look for the atmosphere they wanted to create in the room when they first meet each other, and just playing with the blinds and the trapped feeling and the contrast between the beginning and the end of the movie. It's great.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I've been waiting to try and see it on a screen somewhere.
I want
to
see it on the big screen.
Yes, that would be amazing.
Just from that first opening of the guy walking towards the screen in silhouette on crutches. Just like, what's going to happen in this movie? Like, you don't need, like, what does that have to do with it? I don't know what's happening. Yeah. And then you find out. It's great.
Very cool. Awesome. What is your number one?
Well, you already know what my number one is. Oh. But I'm going to say something else. Just to keep the party going.
Yeah, why not?
Because I had a lot on my list here of honorable mentions. How about The Killing?
Awesome.
1956. Stanley Kubrick.
Love the ending.
Yes.
One of the best endings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome ending.
Very noirish.
Very noirish. This was the one I was mentioning that I thought maybe someone would have on their list. And I was saying the narration is very cool, like from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Wait, did you? Why? We already knew that this was your number one.
No. I was saying I figured someone else would maybe.
You
have
wanted
this
to talk
the
about
list.
The narration of this earlier.
Yeah, I was mentioning narration and something else, and I stopped.
So this is not your number one.
No.
Your number one was Strangers on a Train.
Strangers on a Train was my number
so
one.
So give us a recap.
I'm just talk about something.
Give us a recap.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Recap. Red Rock West. Number five. Number four. Tie between Brick and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Number three is The Grifters. Two, Blade Runner. One, Strangers on a Train. But the killing's awesome, right, guys?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is.
I really like Sterling Hayden.
He's amazing.
So Sterling's like, awesome. Name. I'm going to name
him. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And it's got, we haven't really talked about how great pulpy dialogue is in the early noir movies. You know, it's like.
Well, we didn't really talk
like
about
you've pulp. You've got a dollar sign where your heart should, you know, you've got a dollar sign where your heart should be. And like, it's just, this whole movie is filled with awesome kind of pulpy, you know,
got that
corny,
fast talking.
Yeah, corny anywhere else, but it's just done with such sincerity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's awesome. And
which brings me back to your our number fours, that it was a big task that Rian Johnson had to do to make that work, that dialogue work.
Yeah,
and it works.
Yeah, it works really well.
Easily could have not worked, and just that's could have been its downfall. But no, it totally works.
He was able to take like the kind of meter and rhythm, of pulpy dialogue, but kind of make a new vocabulary out of it to make it work. Yeah. You know, in modern
and a lot of credit to those actors too, because I mean, you know.
They sold it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is just quick, just constantly on the ball.
Yeah.
And the mask in The Killing. Yes. The like the weird, not a clown mask, but it's kind of a mask. Kind of a clown mask.
It's just creepy.
Yeah. It's just creepy.
It's a creepy mask. Yeah. I feel like that's what it should be called. Creepy mask.
Yeah.
Buy your creepy mask here.
Yeah.
And like being set around a horse show, it's such a simple thing, but executed so well.
Yeah,
it was great.
It's one of those movies I feel like I didn't appreciate it as much the first time I saw it, but just like the slow deterioration of everything, to that ending.
Yeah,
which I the ending's my favorite part of the movie, and Sterling Hayden because he's just great.
Yeah, God, the ending is a bummer,
but such an amazing. An amazing bummer.
And then, oh, man. That fucking dog.
Well, that's a good pick. That's not your number one.
It is not. Strangers on a Train is still my number one. Yeah. I just want to talk about something because someone took the wind out of my sails.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, I'll do my recap. My number five was Chinatown, 4 Brick, 3 Memento, 2 Panic in the Streets, and my number one from 2004, Collateral. Come on. Am I going to get a no or a yes? There's a lot of thinking going on, a lot of looking away, no eye contact.
I find this a strange choice for number one.
Well, I'll tell you why. Does it? Is it
you
a
have
noir?
A hard on for
Please,
Michael Mann.
It's why we're here.
Yes, exactly.
I have a hard on for
but
Michael Mann.
But you do that and not like, well, Manhunter isn't a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm only doing this because I started... Yeah, no. But this is what happened. I started doing a list, and then I'm like, I got to have a really like recent movie. And then I said, well, I started looking at all my really favorite directors. And I went straight to, well, Woody Allen didn't have a film.
Before you get into defending yourself, I just want to say that I agree with this, and it would actually probably work on my list, because it is the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I do really like Collateral.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I don't like Collateral.
Okay, so I did my list, and then coincidentally, I wrote down a list, I put Michael Mann, and I'm like, I'm going to come back to it. I go to work, and I have a stack of movies at work that I'll take a stack of movies, and I'll just watch randomly. I'll put them in the background, and I put on Collateral, and I had to come home and rewatch it again because I wasn't paying attention. And I'm like, fuck, I forgot how great this movie is. And I felt it had all the tenets of film noir. And not only is it not in film, it's in digital. So it kind of applies to what we were talking about earlier. And he still conveyed the fact that it's a film noir, even in digital, even...
Digital noir.
Digital noir.
Well, bringing it back to Side by Side, they actually talk about how that movie technically, that's the only way you could have shot that film.
That movie looks exactly how he wanted it to look.
Exactly.
Yes. And I've heard the commentary, and well, we won't get it really into it, but you couldn't have got the depth of field of LA with film.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go digital.
We'll do another episode where we do the commentary track on the commentary track for Collateral.
Yes. But
Michael Mann has made, wait a minute, hold on. Hold it. You couldn't. Now, I'm not going to rely on you guys to explain to me, like, technically why that's not possible. But Michael Mann has made some of the best LA movies ever made.
This movie's...
They're talking about the way you can see into the night.
Yeah,
see into the distance into the night, where you're in the cab and you can see...
The streets.
You can see the distance of L.A. behind you.
Film would not give you that at all.
The way the night looks, where in film you get the blackness, and here you get the haze. They wanted the haze. They wanted... They wanted to see how truly shitty L.A. looks.
Well, and I say that. I like the look of Collateral.
Yeah, no,
and I don't like the look of everything after Collateral.
Okay, I'll agree with you on that.
Everything after Collateral that he did, I feel like looks like dog shit.
I'll agree with you. I'll agree with you.
But that's, Collateral that's does look great.
Yeah, and it's because I'm from born and raised in L.A. and it's like the only movie where I'm like,
you hope to live and die in L.A.
I hope to live in L.A. and it's the first movie where I'm like, this guy, the only person to kind of photograph L.A. like it really is. Shitty.
Hometown boy. Hometown boy. Singing the praises.
That was very poignant.
But that's the appeal of L.A. That's why it's so beautiful, because how...
It's an awful place that you have to be.
Yeah, no. Well, not only that. No. I love L.A. I want to say that. But I'm saying, like, the sunsets, the great sunsets we have, it's because of fucking pollution.
Now I just want to have someone cut a montage of scenes from Collateral with Randy Newman's I Love L.A. playing in the background.
I love L.A.
Oh, my God. This is a tangent, but I was so mad when I found out how ironic that song is. That he really just hates L.A. and everything about it.
Oh. Interesting. You know, in Rednecks, he's not really talking about being proud to be a redneck also, right?
Fucking Randy Newman.
But, yeah, I love this movie.
Wrong
Identity.
Jamie Foxx, Wrong Place, Wrong Time. Yes. Descends into doing things he never thought he'd do. There is a femme fatale, you could say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she doesn't screw him over.
No, she's a nice girl. Yeah. Jada Pinkett.
Yeah.
I don't think that counts as a femme fatale then. She's not a femme fatale. She's a good
girl. Yeah, that's true. The femme fatale is really...
There is no femme fatale in this one.
If there's any femme fatale, it's Tom Cruise. No. It's... I'm trying to remember where it is, but wherever the island is on his little postcard. Anything's a femme fatale, it's the Lady of the Water.
Mount Isad.
Where is it?
I don't know. I think it's like Mount something. This movie is fucking amazing. I literally watched it like 3 times this weekend.
Watching side by side did make me want to revisit Collateral.
Yeah. And I want to see it in Blu-ray just because.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise is awesome.
He's amazing.
So he is great. The nightclub scene.
Yes.
Is unreal.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of like. Also, you explore the psychology of him, of Vincent's character.
Definitely.
I don't think anyone else could have done that character.
No.
Because Tom Cruise is a guy, because there's so little of him there, you need someone as insane as Tom Cruise is to come in and be like, well, I gotta figure this guy out.
Mm-hmm.
And who is this guy? And I'm sure he like... I don't know. I'm sure he like hung out with some like Wet Works guys or something.
Yeah,
did his Tom Cruise thing.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
Also, the thing is, like, you see, like, in the special features of the DVD, you see Michael Mann's like, you're Tom Cruise. Everybody knows you. Now you have to be every man and blend in and make sure nobody knows you. And so, like, he did the hair and he put on glasses.
Yeah, wearing the most outstanding kind of getup and hair. His hair matches his suit.
Yeah,
that's all
you
have to say.
he put on the suit, and in the special features you see he puts on like glasses with a little camera, and he kind of just does like certain things too with his hair, and he goes to like the mall and stores, and no one ever like you don't ever see people like staring at him. Like, he literally like... There's something about like just the slight changes that he made that no one recognizes. God,
he also turned the brightness down on his smile, his high beam smile.
Oh, yeah.
Turned it down a little bit.
Yes.
Not quite see in the dark bright.
God, I love Tom Cruise.
I do.
Yeah.
It's weird. But like, I feel like
I don't think it's weird at all. I love Tom Cruise.
But part of me feels like I shouldn't, but I do. Like,
Why shouldn't you?
I don't know. I just feel like society doesn't want me to. Yeah,
he's so nice.
It's so weird. Yeah, no. And I've never heard anyone who's ever worked with him not say like, no, he's great. He comes to work. He's the most prepared guy I've ever worked with. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah,
but he's a weirdo.
I have a friend who had a meeting with Tom Cruise, and he said like he was kind of like asking advice. Like, it was just like this personal like meeting, like just one on one. He's like, the one fucking thing I tell you is fucking mind your manners. He didn't say fucking. I added that for dramatic.
Mind your fucking manners.
No, he's
you
like,
fuck.
Tom,
he's,
I'm getting mixed messages. He's like, can I call you Tom?
He's like, oh, always be nice. And he's like, mind your manners. Like, he's like, and no one will ever have anything bad to say about you. And it's so true. Like,
oh, now that makes me think like he's actually a real asshole because he's got the artifice of being.
Wait, but I mean,
well, he's got the nice manners.
Hold on, though, but that doesn't make sense because he does mind his manners, but people do say bad things about him.
Yeah, well, people say bad things about him because it's trendy to say bad things about
him. Yeah, yeah. I like him.
But he's the only guy that people say really bad things about. But there's not. I don't know.
I don't think I've ever seen a Tom Cruise movie where he's been why I didn't like the movie.
Oh no, no, yeah.
He's never the reason I dislike a movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So there's that.
Yeah.
So there's just something fascinating about him.
And that's why it's my number one. I love Michael Mann. And it's the only one of the few movies where I fucking love Jamie Foxx's acting. I
feel like he should have got the Oscar for this and not for doing an impersonation of Ray Charles.
Because I feel like in every other one of his roles, I don't know about Django. I haven't seen it. But he's impersonating something. I mean, he's just doing impersonation of who he thinks he's supposed to do. Where he's just,
well, I don't know, in Bates. I mean, that character. I really felt
well,
that
and
character.
It's interesting. Booty you say Call. That.
I really do love Booty Call.
I do. Love Booty Call.
I feel like Collateral and Any Given Sunday.
Yeah,
those
are
the two realist, like most real characters. I feel like he's done where it's not realist, most real, whatever. I don't care. It's the boost. It's your fault.
He's laying it down.
but I think that's interesting. You say that in a movie. Bringing up Collateral because you have because they both work on their charisma, and so you have Tom Cruise who is all charisma. He is 100% an animal of charisma, but he can be a star, but he can still play a specific character, and he still has that it factor. You still want to watch everything he does because he's got that thing, but you still believe him as the character he's playing. Whereas Jamie Foxx, you always kind of see, you can see him at the end of a scene going off and being Jamie Foxx. Like, it always feels like he's being Jamie Foxx, even though Tom Cruise always feels like he's being Tom Cruise, but it works for some reason.
Yes. And I really want to talk about this part of, I was like, the second viewing I had this weekend, I thought of this. Every single character in this movie that he encounters or Vincent encounters could have had their own movie made out of that night, like Mark Ruffalo's character, the detective, or Peter Berg's, like just they're in it for a very couple of scenes, just like 2-3 scenes, and I want to know more. I'm like, where was this guy before, like this night? What was he investigating? What the hell's up with the whole case? Like, what did he do bad? And the scene that really sticks out that as one of my favorite scenes is the Javier Bardem scene, like Javier Bardem. He's just, and I was just watching how he filmed it. Like, he's telling a story about Santa Claus, Javier Bardem is, and it doesn't cut to Jamie Foxx's reaction. It's just a long ass take on Javier Bardem.
Well, you got Javier Bardem
because he's so fucking captivating. Like, he's just so, he's telling a story and he has your attention, and you're not thinking like, oh, we're just looking. No, you're paying attention. Mm-hmm. You're like, he's amazing, and he plays that threat because he is like the head of the cartel, but he never shows you like, oh, look, this I got to like show off how strong I am. It's just in this little story, and you're like, I'm scared of this guy. I don't want to ever meet this guy. And I want to see his story. Like, what's up with his whole like rise. And so anyway,
it's weird looking at the screenwriter's filmography.
Yes. Stuart Beatty.
Yeah. He wrote Collateral and all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and Derailed.
Not the first one. I thought the first one was
Curse of the Black
Shrek,
Pearl.
Shrek guys.
Curse of the Black Pearl.
I once got to see a Q&A with Chuck Russell. Did you see that with me? Were you there when Chuck Russell spoke?
Yes, that was at the film festival.
Yeah, and he talked about how that movie's not. That's not correct.
Wait, which movie?
Frank Darabont had a huge hand in Collateral.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Huge hand.
Oh, okay.
And it's all WGA, like, you know, arbitration stuff. But Frank Darabont and Michael Mann had a huge, huge part in that, writing that movie.
I was going to say, because based on his other work, it does not seem like.
No.
No, we're saying thumbs down on Australia.
No.
That seems, based on whatever, what else I see here, that seems like something he would have written.
And also, the colonel of the idea was his. You know, because I've heard, I've also been to Stuart Beatty Q&A, and he talks about how he's just in a cab, and he's like, "How do it's weird how like I don't know this guy, and I'm trusting him with my life. He's driving me around, and that's where the idea came from. But all the whole story itself is all Frank Darabont, yeah, Shawshank style. all right, that's it for me. Any honorable mentions you guys want to talk about?
The Big Sleep.
Yeah.
Maltese Falcon.
Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, okay.
Let's mention
here's,
all the ones.
Here's the honorable mentions. Yeah, Rebecca.
Everything.
So everything. Everything on the film noir list.
Mildred Pierce. The one with Joan Crawford. Anyone else seen that?
No.
That was one of the first ones I ever watched. And it's a weird, on the cusp of film noir, another wrong person at the wrong place at the wrong time, where it's like she goes out of her way to, I mean, I don't know about the miniseries, but she goes out of her way to like build herself up all for her daughter, and then she gets screwed over. Yeah. And it's great. It's Joan Crawford being awesome.
Last Seduction?
I haven't seen that.
I miss Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah.
What happened to Linda Fiorentino?
Apparently she's difficult to work with.
Yep. Yes. That's all people talk about.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pete Berg, isn't that?
Yep.
Yeah. He's the dude. Yeah. The guy in the wrong place at the wrong time.
She plays an awesome, just cold bitch. Is it? You know, conniving.
Bill Pullman?
Villain.
Yes.
Yes, right. Yeah. He's the husband. Key Largo, one of mine.
Key Largo.
The Man Who Wasn't There.
I did not like The Man Who Wasn't
There. Really?
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah, I loved The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah. We could go another hour on this Man Who Wasn't There, but I won't.
I've actually recently been wanting to watch The Man Who Wasn't There.
I saw it a long time ago. I feel like I may have not been in the right...
I remember enjoying it.
Yeah.
I remember, I mean, because it gets pretty dark, like still with James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember feeling overpowered by the artifice of it as opposed to the story. Just everything being black and white, everyone smoking a lot. Yeah, he's a barber, an everyday guy.
The precision of the haircutting scenes was...
Yeah. I enjoyed that because that's very Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
But,
no, it was just amazing to me. I was like, what the...
Yeah, see, I almost my number one, and this might be a discussion, is Casablanca.
That's film noir. I would throw it on there.
And I almost brought it up because I thought maybe it was on someone's list. I almost brought it up when you're talking about Chinatown as far as screenwriting goes.
Yes.
Because everyone talk, and it's not the case with Citizen Kane, because I actually do think over time Citizen Kane kind of gets overblown.
Yes.
But it is still one of the best movies ever made, but there are other things that are interesting for the same reasons. But Casablanca, every line in Casablanca is perfect.
Yeah.
Every single character interaction, everything about it is perfect.
I would say Casablanca, Chinatown, and Butch Cassidy. I would throw that in there.
Butch Cassidy?
For his dialogue being perfect.
I'm talking about like script writing.
We're talking about script writing. Yeah.
Those are the three movies that I'd say like, I mean... that are like the best, like Bible to go off of. You know,
if you want to learn, you know, the economy of story and just everything.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Notorious.
Yeah.
And I actually had The Thin Man, not the sequels. The first one I would call noir.
Yeah.
The sequels they got more into the comedy of it, and they're just more straight up mysteries. And I actually enjoy the sequels more. But the original is
that's why it's an honorable mention.
Yeah, that's why it's an honorable mention. The Thin Man.
Yeah,
my dad's favorite series. He'd be upset if I didn't mention.
I'll mention this movie real quick, and you might poo-poo it, but No Country for Old Men.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah,
I just criminal element. 100%.
Javier Bardem.
Dark.
Yeah.
Doom
super
characters.
Dark.
Yeah.
Desperation.
It's
trapped.
Neo-noir western right along with Red Rock West.
Yeah, that'd be a good double feature.
Yeah.
What else did I have? Oh, I had In Bruges.
Interesting.
I
see that.
Yeah.
In Bruges is one of my... It might be my favorite movie of the past 10 years.
Really?
I love In Bruges.
I love In Bruges as well.
I did really love it. I don't know...
Yeah.
Favorite movie the last 10 years.
It's just, I maybe it was that I was so surprised by it. And now this is kind of getting a tangent, but then there's a new Michael McDonald movie. Seven Psychopaths.
Yeah, I really want to see that.
But the trailer is awful, I think. I think the trailer makes it look terrible, but the trailer for In Bruges also made it look terrible.
It's true.
Yes. And so did the poster. Like, they totally played it as this, like, straight-out comedic, like, trying to be Pulp Fiction, maybe, kind of hitman story that's really funny. And it is hilarious. And Bruges is great. But it's also incredibly dark and sad in parts. And I feel, and I'm hoping that's the same case with Seven Psychopaths.
Yeah, I'm hoping that as well. Because of I love In Bruges. I fucking love it. And because of that movie, I went on vacation. I'm like, we gotta go to Bruges. We stayed a night in Bruges.
Wow.
And I climbed up the fucking tower.
But and like talking about noir, it's interesting because they're already, you know, quote unquote bad people.
Yeah.
Going a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, based on their circumstance, you know, and they're put into the circumstance that will dictate, you know, how far.
Well, that desperation.
It's got that desperation. Yeah.
And there's a femme fatale.
There's a femme fatale. And that, oh my, oh, and that scene with Ralph Fiennes.
Ralph Fiennes, just in general, in that movie, is amazing.
It's so great.
I like when the hotel lady's reading the Ralph Fiennes, the message. And she like bleeps out like. Like all the curse words.
Why seriously, though, that was such a terrible trailer.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about it because I remember it was one of those movies where like, I got nothing else to do. I guess I'll check it out. And I was like, oh my gosh, whoever made that trailer should be shot because I love this movie. And that trailer was terrible.
Yeah, it plays it like a goofy.
At the same time, maybe it's just because I know how much I like In Bruges, where I enjoy the trailer. I mean, I enjoy the trailer for Seven Psychopaths just because seeing those people. Because
you know what you're in for.
See, that's the thing. I know I know the writer, so I know what kind of thing.
You know how dark it can get. It's like you can in your mind you can see the darkness on the periphery of what they're showing you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know that that's the only stuff they can show you, and you can.
Maybe that's part of the problem. Just especially with Ralph Fiennes' lines and In Bruges, just the lack of things they can show him doing.
Yeah, I don't think Ralph Fiennes in the trailer at all, except for maybe a shot.
Yeah,
like they show him angry. Yeah. No, the boss angry.
They show they show him buying the gun. He's like, do you want an AK? He's like, does it look like I'm a gangster in Los Angeles?
And they left out fucking,
But,
gangster fucking Los Angeles.
Yeah. This movie's pretty amazing. If you have a chance, check out, read his plays. He did The Lieutenant of Ishmore and The Pillow Man, which are really great.
The one I wanted to see, and we are way off topic now, but the one with Christopher Walken, where he didn't have any, I think, like, he didn't have any hands. It was a recent play.
I don't remember.
I'm trying to remember what it was called.
I don't think it was the Lieutenant Division.
But that's way off.
Yeah. Anyway, any honorable mentions, Kevin, you want to talk about?
I already mentioned The Big Sleep.
All right, dude. Don't yell at me.
L.A. Confidential.
Okay. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
I was really surprised that one didn't pop up at all.
Yeah.
All-time favorite.
Well, I feel like we talked about that a lot when Brian...
We did, but did it actually come up as... I mean, it wasn't on anybody's list or anything.
No, no. That's why he was originally invited, so we could talk about L.A. Confidential.
Public Enemy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Jimmy Cagney. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was stuck in Michael Madman. I was like, wait, you just said you hated everything after Collateral.
Yeah, not Public Enemy.
And I want to say... I want to say...
Public Enemy.
I haven't... I love everything he's done after Collateral. I just don't like the way it was filmed. So, but I do love all his movies. I stand behind them.
We understand.
I didn't like them either.
All right.
Let's talk about movies that we do like.
Yeah. I need to see Miami Vice again.
Yes.
Oh, The Long Goodbye.
Yes. Long Goodbye.
Which it's mentioned in my film noir book, and it is neo noir ish, but at the same time, it's like the least dark noir movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so...
Elliot Gould.
Yeah. Like, it's so bright and he's so wry.
Even if you wanted
funny.
To make it dark.
Yeah. Well, even when it is dark, it's like... There's something about it. Like the scene with the guy and his girlfriend and he breaks the glass against her. Like, that's probably the darkest moment followed by like someone getting shot. And like, yeah, there are dark things going on. But I feel like a lot of the dark things happen off camera. But I do love the movie.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll use it for another.
Yeah, noir is one of the few genres where violence against women.
It's just.
The hero
all,
hits women all the time and can still be considered a hero.
Like
in Public Enemy, where he just slaps her.
Well, I feel like in film noir, just everybody hits everyone. Everybody hits a woman for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's The Big Heat, where Lee Marvin plays a character who throws a pot of hot boiling coffee in a woman's face and like scalds her badly. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. The big combo, I love the look of. Not my, necessarily my favorite movie. It's a movie with Lee Van Cleef is in it as one of the criminals. It's just a messed up film noir.
Would you say Drive is a film noir?
Yeah. A neo-noir. I mean, because along the lines of Thief, I think that's also a neo-noir.
Yeah.
It's just a very... It's a European-tinged... Like, there's something a little bit different. Like, they tweak something where... Mm.
You know what they do?
What are they add 80s music?
No, they kind of just calm everything down, make it a little still.
Mm, they like the stillness.
I like what you're throwing at me. all right, well, let's wrap it up because we're going on 2 hours. So.
All right, Devil in a Blue Dress.
Devil in a Blue Dress.
Oh!
Yeah.
Denzel is badass.
Sorry, I forgot Devil in a Blue Dress.
Easy Rollins. He's got to have a Walter Mosley. Don Cheadle's great as Mouse. Yeah. Tom Sizemore. Again, part of the problem is the same thing we had with the Outlaw thing, where it's like there's a blending of genres where it's like detective stories and whatnot.
Lawrence Fishburne plays a Walter Mosley character in a movie. It was
Outnumbered, Always Outgunned.
Yes. Amazing.
Yeah.
The book is also amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that I'll wrap it up. And find us on the Twitter. At the Film Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Ricardo, U-L-T-R-E-R-A-S.
You can find me at K-Zuberbeer, that's Z-U-B-E-R-B-I-E-R.
I'm at an Adam Scott, A-N underscore Adam Scott.
I am at B-L Bennett, just as it sounds.
And and if you want to read more in-depth reviews or any stuff like that, you can go over to Adam Scott's website, shootingthescript.com. Or what's the other one?
Blog.moviepass.com.
There you go. And then if you're going to buy anything, if you're still listening, if you're going to buy anything off of Amazon, just click on our website and then click through our link, our Amazon link, and that will help us, you know, buy new equipment, crap like that. Or just buy any DVDs to watch. But that's it, I think, for this week. And until next week, that's it, right? Anything else you guys want to plug?
I think that's it.
All right.
Goodbye.